This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Years ago, I was in the event videography business. I would videotape weddings and bar mitzvahs and retirement parties and all sorts of other things. I did that for, I'd say, 4 or 5 years, part-time. Did a little on my own a little bit, worked for another company a little bit, worked for a few other people. So I attended a great many weddings, far too many weddings for one lifetime, I'll be honest. And I was always curious about interfaith weddings. And I was always curious about how people of different faiths, doesn't matter what the faiths were, Jewish, Catholic, atheist and evangelical Christian, whatever the case may be. I was always curious about how people of different faiths balanced that. And I remember I was at one wedding one time where they were being married by a rabbi. It was an interfaith wedding, and they were being married by a rabbi and a Catholic Monsignor. And this Monsignor, I think I remember the name of this Monsignor. It's just so long ago. It's over 20 years ago, so I'm hesitant to rely solely on my memory. So I won't mention the Monsignor's name. But what he said with me struck so much of a chord, and I never forgot it. You have a lot of couples who recognize that interfaith families can be very challenging. And they occasionally make the mistake of making faith and making religion less a part of their marriage. And they allow, they make it so that religion is on the back burner so they don't have to face the challenging questions about faith when you have an interfaith marriage. Now, I have to say, this week I thought about that whole situation again when I read article after article about a Quinnipiac University poll released on Monday that found nearly two-thirds of Americans have no appetite to talk about politics this Thanksgiving. Quinnipiac University poll released Monday showed 66% of adults are hoping to avoid conversations about politics at the dinner table this year, a sentiment that includes most Democrats, Republicans, and independents, while 21% say they're looking forward to hashing out their political views while feasting on the meal. 68% of Republicans, 66% of Democrats, and 69% of my fellow independents say they want to leave politics at the dining room door. The survey also found that nearly three quarters of Americans said heated political debates among family or friends were not so likely or not likely at all, compared with 24% who said such discussions were very likely or somewhat likely. Now, all I could think in looking at these numbers, seeing how two-thirds of Americans don't want to discuss politics when they get together with friends and family this Thursday for Thanksgiving, all I could think is, what a shame. What a shame. As a country, I think one of the problems we have is that people are not well-informed enough, that they don't learn from people they disagree with. They don't ask the right questions. And just like that Monsignor who married that couple two decades ago, maybe more, said that couples occasionally make the mistake of leaving faith out of their marriage when they come from different religious persuasions, I think it's a tremendous mistake for people not to discuss politics with their loved ones. So what I'd like to do for the first hour is I know a lot of you are going to get together with family and friends on Thursday, and many of you may get together with family and friends who you differ with politically. And what I'd like to do for the next few minutes is help everybody listening, no matter what their politics are, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, libertarian, or vegetarian, no matter what their politics are, help them to have productive conversations so that they can learn from the people around them and they can maybe even help persuade some of the people around them so things don't become angry, things don't become a shouting match. Because this whole era that we're in now, where we feel for the sake of harmony that we have to leave politics at the door, is not healthy. It is not healthy whatsoever. I'd say in my family, my Uncle Carmine was a liberal Democrat. My Uncle Joe is a conservative Republican. And the conversations that we used to have, the three of us, at every family function was so informative. It really helped frame, it allowed me to help determine what my own views were on subjects. It was an incredible fertile training ground for my being a talk show host later in life. It inspired in me a love of learning about the process that I wish every American had. And I want to have productive conversations around the Thanksgiving table. Not angry conversations, but friendly conversations. So I would like to know your strategies for helping others do that. 800-848-9222. That's 800-848-WABC. We're going to talk with Jennifer Borquevos, who is America's social worker, coming up in about 20 minutes. She has some interesting thoughts on this regard. But one of the most interesting things one of the most interesting things that I've ever seen was last Thanksgiving. And it was from a group called Unity 2020. And I found the strategies that they had collated from reading a bunch of different scholars, Marshall Rosenberg, George Thompson, Don Miguel Ruiz, Peter Boghossian, James Lindsay. I found the strategies that they gave to be so effective. And I'm going to share them with you, because this is what I've tried to do, not only around the Thanksgiving table, but around, but on this radio show, quite frankly, when we have callers or guests that are bickering at one another's throats and just incredibly angry. And it talks about how to give thanks with meaningful discussions. And it offers 6 tips, okay? And I'm going to share them with you now because I found them incredibly helpful. Number one is don't lecture. The dinner table is not a classroom. Few things put people off more than an unsolicited lecture. Think about what you're saying. Is it in response to a question asked by somebody? Did someone indicate that they want to know your views on this topic? If the answer to these questions is no, then you're probably lecturing. This is so important. So important. When you get together Thursday with family and friends that may differ politically, number one, don't lecture. Number two, and this is a device that I try to use on this show, ask questions. Leading with questions instead of statements of fact is the best way to create conversation. Facts are loaded with associations and often lead us down the rabbit hole of sources. Asking questions requires your interlocutor to examine their reasoning and values first. Number three, humanize. It's easy to pigeonhole others into categories when talking about politics. Just listening to the last couple of minutes of Dominic Carter's show just now, one caller called people she disagreed with Nazis. Another person called people they disagreed with racist. Humanize. You want to it's easy to pigeonhole when we talk about politics. However, just as issues are complex, so are people. Try to find common ground. even if it's only tangentially related to the subject. If you both love pumpkin pie, make that part of the conversation. Four, summarize their position. Before responding, try to articulate the position of the other person better than they did. This signals that you're listening and validates their opinion. Number five, I think, instigate doubt. We're more likely to question our beliefs if we feel that the doubt comes from ourselves. So to spur an investigation into someone else's beliefs, feign ignorance and ask them to explain their position to you. By asking someone to define their own beliefs, any blind spots will become clear on their own terms, making them more likely to engage in deeper conversation. And then lastly, find a way out. Don't make the conversation about winning or losing. Instead, try to build a bridge between your points of view that you can both live with. If you have the courage to change your mind or concede on something, chances are whomever you're talking to will as well. I found that list incredibly helpful, and I have utilized it in the year since, both in my familial and social functions and in terms of trying to do this show. Give me your tips. Give the audience your tips on talking politics at the Thanksgiving table with people you disagree with without it getting angry, without it turning into a shouting match. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let me begin with Byron in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Byron.
Hello, Frank. How are you? You got a great show.
Thanks.
Listen, I must disagree with you on this.
How dare you?
I know. How dare me do that? But anyway, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say I've got a daughter who works for Planned Parenthood. Do you really think Thanksgiving dinner is the place where I ought to engage her in a debate about abortion? How about some other time? Thanksgiving, leave the politics out, leave the hot button issues out, leave all of that out and just do family, okay? Some other time we can debate about abortion. We can debate about, you know, Black Lives Matter. We can debate about critical race theory. Some other time. But Thanksgiving, leave it alone. And that goes for other holidays as well. Christmas, Easter, all of that stuff. What do you think?
I look, you turned it into a debate, right? So you used the word debate. I didn't. I think it can be a discussion. Let's say you had a daughter that worked for Planned Parenthood. You're pro-life, I am assuming.
Don't assume too much.
Okay.
We don't have to go there. But anyway.
So then what would be the disagreement?
Whether you like it or not, it's gonna turn into a debate.
Well,
right?
No, but that's why I'm trying to give the people listening more of the tools that I just listed. If you use the strategies that I just listed, and hopefully some others that the listeners come up with, it doesn't have to be. Let's say you are pro-life, and let's say your daughter is virulently pro-choice, and she's with Planned Parenthood or something like that. Well, a great place to start is, hey, don't you think it would be great if we could reduce the number of abortions in this country by doing things like making it a lot easier for certain couples to adopt, right? So now you're not challenging their belief on anything. You're getting to the point where we agree. Hey, can we reduce the number of abortions in this country? And let's say you know that you're just going to disagree. That's where that asking questions is so important, right? So you can ask the question, let's say if you're pro-life and your daughter's pro-choice, you can ask the question, well, can we agree that abortion at, in the ninth month of a pregnancy is not something that should be permitted? Okay, can we agree? Yes. All right. Can we agree that maybe in the eighth month of a pregnancy, it should be something that's not permitted? So wouldn't it be nice if Washington could have the same kind of conversation on this front that we do? So no matter what the issue, there's always a way to have a productive conversation about it. Always, always. And I want to help the listeners for the next few minutes develop their own toolkit so that they can have those conversations. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Albert is in New Jersey. Hello, Albert.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you.
I'm doing good. Listen, first of all, that guy that just called, there's no such a thing as not pro-life. There's no such a thing as pro-choice. You got to be pro-life. And he's the fact that he was ashamed to say it, he wouldn't say it straight up. Pro-choice is pro-murder. Just follow the science. Yeah, all these people saying follow the science. The science is that they're, you know, the fetus feels and the fetus hears.
All right, Albert, so give me your tips for how people can handle Thanksgiving dinner with friends or relatives they may disagree with.
Well, I think that a little bit along the lines of that guy was saying, you know, that guy was saying, try not to bring up politics. That's a key. Try not to bring up politics. There's a lot of other things to talk about. Now, if you don't want to debate and you want to just have, you know, something, let's say talk about gas prices. Why do you think it's going up? But like you were saying, don't say a fact. Ask questions. Why do you think it's going up? And there could be a lot of different possibilities. Now, I personally think it's Biden, and I know that it's Biden why it's going up. But, there are a lot of factors into why the gas would be going up. So that's one way to do it. Don't ask it as a fact, like you were saying.
All right, so you like the ask question strategy. All right, I think that's good. 800-848-922, so hopefully that'll be something that people adopt. Neil is on Staten Island. Hello, Neil.
Yeah, Frank, you know, we're so divided with politics. I don't even know if politics should be brought up. However, I would say something like to my brother who voted for Biden, I would say, well, you get the turkey butt because you voted for a butt. But someone that voted for Cuomo, I say, well, you get a little breast meat.
Well, that's very funny. And I think using humor is a great way to, to kind of alleviate some of the tension. But I don't think you should attack people for who they voted for. You got to recognize if you voted for Trump and someone else voted for Biden, well, there's tens of millions of people in this country that voted for Biden. Same thing if you voted for Biden and someone else voted for Trump. There's tens of millions of people that voted for Trump. So I don't think you should attack someone for who they voted for. Try and find out why. Why? What made you vote for XYZ of a candidate? Instigate doubt. Summarize their position, find a way out, humanize, ask questions, don't lecture. That is the playbook from a lot of sources that I've come to respect, and I'd love to hear if you have your own strategies for helping people discuss politics at Thanksgiving, not ignoring politics on Thanksgiving. Because we can learn from each other. We can learn from our family that we disagree with. We can learn from our friends that we can disagree with. We can have a laugh together. We can understand better our own positions. Because you know what? Sometimes you get a thorough understanding of an issue when you try to explain why you believe in something. Right? And if you can explain why you believe in something, then sometimes that passion that you might have in explaining your own belief in an issue, that could translate to winning someone else over. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Sharon is in Manhattan. Hello, Sharon.
Hi. I think I'm going to just go along the same lines that you're talking about, but I just wanted to tell a story. I live in Manhattan, and my family's is in Connecticut, or was in Connecticut, and my sister-in-law believed that you don't talk about politics or religion.
I think that's a shame. I know a lot of families have that kind of rule, and I think that's a shame, because I want to learn about politics and religion.
Me too. So there was one gentleman, probably about 70 years old. I was probably in my early 30s, and we were the only ones that talked about politics at this whole family dinner at Thanksgiving, you know, and I would come up to Connecticut, you know, every year, and we both looked forward to, you know, to seeing each other. So he would say, oh, is Sharon coming up this year? And I would say, oh, is that guy going to be there? You know, and we talked about everything. And I guess he was a Republican and I'm a Democrat. And he kept trying to get me to listen to Rush Limbaugh. So he kept, you know, but we had the best conversations. and good-natured humor, you know, and well, we just enjoyed, great. We totally enjoyed the day.
So, Sharon, what was the key to the success that you had conversationally with that other gentleman? What did you two do to avoid having the discussion turn into an angry shouting match, as it appears to happen in so many other families?
I think we looked forward to hearing the other person's opinion.
Right. That's the key.
And we kind of like sparred. We sort of laughed at each other. You know, he would say, what about this? And I'd say, I don't know. What about this story? Oh, what about that? And it went back and forth, and it just energized the whole day because everybody else was talking about the latest store that opened at the mall.
Right, you know? Right. See, what are you doing Thursday, Sharon? What are your plans for this Thanksgiving Thursday?
I'm just staying in Manhattan. I live in Chelsea. I'm pretty liberal.
Well, email me if you want to come to my mom's, because you're exactly the kind of person that I want to spend holidays with,
that's
Sharon.
That's wonderful.
That is true. 800-848-WABC. That's 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Drew in White Plains. Hello, Drew.
Hey, Frank. You know what's so interesting? This is such a great topic because the world needs to understand that you have to understand the other side in order to accomplish certain things.
Mm-hmm.
I saw something earlier, right, Frank? And I know this is going to bug you out with what I'm about to say. I saw a poll. The poll has Trump ahead in all these swing states.
Right, the five states that Biden flipped. I saw that poll, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I said, well, the most important thing for 2022, and I said if I was Trump, would be the layoff of the Georgia governor, because, you know, if he happens to lose, if Stacey Abrams wins, you know, that could put Trump in a very vulnerable situation if she's running the elections in Georgia. But not only this, this is where I'm going to bust your head at. I said he needs to disappear from New York politics. And I said, why? I said, in order for Trump to get back in office, he has to lose to win. What do I mean by that? He has to try and throw a Hail Mary and hope a Republican could get in that governorship in New York. Why? Because he's under investigation from, and I'm a Democrat, and I'm going to say it, hyper-political district attorneys who are going to make a case out of him. You know, I know it's hard when people say, you know, to get an indictment on a former sitting president, but I feel like the day and age that we're in such a political day and age, people are going to do it anyway.
Well,
and especially if they feel like he might be able to get back in office.
Yeah, Drew.
So I feel like, well,
here's where I, first of all, I don't know that this is necessarily the kind of tips that I had in mind for helping people have constructive conversations Thursday, but here's where I part company with you and why. I think that, one, if Stacey Abrams wins in Georgia, that is the best thing that could happen for Donald Trump if he chooses to run in 2024. Because, one, it's still the Secretary of State that administers the elections in Georgia. And two, Stacey Abrams is almost as polarizing as Donald Trump is. And she would cause every right-leaning voter and every person that would vote against her to be extra motivated to run to the polls in 2024. Okay. As far as your speculation about an indictment, I don't disagree that there is a lot of partisanship from the Manhattan DA's office and the Attorney General's office. What I do disagree with... don't get me started on her. But where I do disagree with is I don't think if Trump was indicted, it would do anything to decrease his standing. In fact, I actually think that if Trump were to be indicted, you would have some more of his supporters rally to him because they would view him as being the victim of a political persecution. So I don't think that would cause him to diminish to have any of his support diminished. The only thing that I think would really cause a lot of Trump supporters to abandon him en masse is if more and more people get tired of, I'll just call it the Trump show, right? It is the constant remarks about, you know, this nickname, that nickname, the attacking the morning news pundits and things like that. A lot of times people just get exhausted by that stuff. And I could see somebody saying, all right, OK, I don't like Joe Biden's policies, but I'm just not ready to go back to 4 years of reading about Little Marco and Lion Ted and Crooked Hillary and Sleepy Joe. And I just think that is a way that that'll cause Trump some of his support. But honestly, the best thing that Trump has going for him, and again, this is not the conversation that I want to have. I wanted to have a conversation about how to have conversations. The best thing that Trump has going for him is Joe Biden. I mean, if you look at where Biden is on inflation, if you look at where he is on the border, if you look at the results that we've seen in terms of violent crime in America's cities, if you look at where we are on the world stage, including in Afghanistan, I think that poll that you cited, Drew, really does reflect that people are ready for just the opposite of where we're at now. 800-848-WABC. But I don't want to have a Trump versus Biden discussion. I got Drew suckered me into a Trump versus Biden discussion. Instead, I want to have a conversation about how whatever your politics are, you can have a conversation about politics this Thursday when you get together with friends and family that you disagree with and have a productive conversation. I hate it when I go to a function, a family function or whatever, and somebody says, oh, no, let's not discuss politics. No, I want to discuss politics. I want to learn why people believe what they say they believe. And I want to be able to understand where they're coming from on certain issues. And I think that will be helpful to the country. I don't think not having constructive conversation on these issues is the solution. I think that'll make things worse because it becomes easier when the people on the other side politically are just this nameless, faceless group of people that are either dumb or racist or hate-filled or backwards for whatever reason. It becomes easier to dig in on your own positions. But if you see, wait a minute, the people voting for the other guy are my friends, my neighbors, my relatives, then it forces you to understand their perspective a little bit and work towards understanding why they're at where they're at. We'll continue with your calls in a minute, and we'll get into this with Jennifer Bourquivas in just a few minutes. But here's something that should bring everybody together, and that is Life Change Tea. You've heard the commercials, and some of you might be asking, what the heck is Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com, and what makes it such a great product? Well, I'm here to tell you. Life Change Tea is a gentle daily cleanse that tastes great and works to get things moving. Stress can wreak havoc on our digestive tract, and if you're feeling stopped up and bloated, it's never a good thing. Life Change Tea is all natural and non-GMO. One package will last you an entire month. Life Change Tea is only available by logging on to the website GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. Use the promo code Frank for free shipping. That's promo code Frank. It is time to feel relief. While you're there, you could check out all the great products designed for your optimum health. Don't miss out. Go to Life Change Tea at GetTheTea.com. It is the tea that makes you go. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank.
Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
With a little love and some tenderness, we'll walk upon the water, we'll rise above the mist. With a little peace and some harmony, we'll take the world together, we'll take them by the hand. Yeah.
That's Hootie and the Blowfish. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. I am, we're talking a little bit about Thanksgiving and how to have difficult discussions and how to make sure that there doesn't get to be fist fights as people are fighting over the wishbone. Oh, because someone voted for Trump or someone voted for Biden. Someone's pro-vaccine mandate. Someone's against vaccine mandate, whatever the case may be. And someone that is just great at having difficult conversations and giving advice to others on how to do so is my friend Jennifer Bohr Cuevas. She is a licensed clinical social worker. In fact, they call her America's social worker. And we're kind enough to she's kind enough to join us on the radio this morning. Hello, Jennifer. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, my friend. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well, Jennifer. Hey, before we get into this Thanksgiving discussion, you were really one of the most passionate advocates in the whole state on the issue of opposing distance learning. Now we're seeing some school districts, including in Detroit, start going to partial remote learning or partial distance learning. What are you seeing here in terms of the trend with respect to distance learning or remote learning? And remind folks why that's so deleterious towards children and maybe even to teachers.
Distance learning, I think we've come a long way in New York. We are back in the school buildings, and thank God it was so detrimental to children to be out of the school buildings, to their social, emotional health. And we've really come a long way. And you're right, in other states, we are seeing that some of them are resorting back to remote learning for reasons other than COVID. There was one school district, I do forget where, what state, but they had to go back to remote learning because the social skills of the children were in such bad shape, and the behaviors and the fighting. Thank God, though, here in New York, I think we're on a good trajectory.
All right, Jennifer. Now, let's say somebody is a devout Trump supporter and their brother, their cousin, their uncle, their parent is a big, big Biden supporter. They all want to get together come Thursday for the holiday, but they don't want it to turn into a screaming match. How do people handle that? What's the solution?
It is good to have a plan, my friend. It is good to have a plan. Look, we are in polarizing times right now, and not just over politics, but over, as you had said before, the vaccine, the mask mandates, all the mitigation efforts. We want to handle people, our loved ones, carefully. And preparation can be so important to help us keeping our emotions in check. A lot of us are having anticipatory anxiety over what's going to happen as we host our holiday tables. And I want to say, too, that, you know, not everything that we anticipate turns into a reality. However, you do want to have that plan. You want to maybe lay some ground rules, maybe let your guests know that you don't want to talk about politics. You could talk about, you could say it in a humorous way. You also want to maybe not completely dismiss other opinions if the politics do come up. And don't take the bait. People fall for the bait so often, and that's where they get themselves in trouble. It's okay to have a differing opinion from somebody else, and you're not going to change somebody else's mind about their opinion. Their political opinion.
So follow me down that road, Jennifer. Let's say it's a very polarizing issue, whatever the issue is. Maybe it's the death penalty, maybe it's abortion, maybe it's vaccine mandates, whatever the case may be. And someone unsolicited, let's say, is expressing a point of view that you vehemently disagree with on any of those hot button issues. How do you either get out of that conversation, or how do you participate in that conversation in a way that doesn't make people go for one another's throats?
It is possible to engage in a political discussion without causing mayhem if you are willing to accept that people have differing opinions. And that means respectfully listening to what somebody else has to say and trying very hard not to be combative. It is possible, and I know I keep repeating myself, for two opposite opinions to exist. But at the end of the day, Frank, if people can't handle the opinion that they're hearing, it's okay to disengage and either one, change the topic and deflect, or get up from the moment and then try to return to it after a little bit of a break.
All right. Well, it's certainly good advice, Jennifer. All right. One of the hot button issues that's been taking place even before you get to wherever you're going for Thanksgiving has been the issue of vaccines. Now, let's say someone chooses not to get vaccinated, and let's say there's a household that says, well, we only want vaccinated guests. Now, I've seen this in my own family, not for Thanksgiving, but for Christmas Eve. My father throws a big party, and, you know, they're making sure all the guests are vaccinated. What do you do in that instance, Jennifer, if someone is hosting and they want everybody vaccinated, then that might leave a couple of people out? How do you handle that? How do you negotiate that?
You know, what people I recommend that they do is they start with their own value system, because if you buy into your own value system, then it's easier to live it and it's easier to handle the disapproval that will probably come your way from some of your loved ones. So if you are somebody that wants all of your guests to be vaccinated, then you need to make that clear and be transparent with those people. And you need to communicate this to your guests ahead of time so that they do have time to air their concerns. You're going to listen to them, but you're also going to respond with, this is what we need to do for our family right now. And I know you may have a different opinion, and I do respect that, but this is what we need to do for our family. And be prepared for the blowback, because people, I'm hearing it through my practice, Frank, that people are having these hurt feelings with their family members right now as we get closer to Thursday. But if you can acknowledge the differences and the opinions and restate that this is what's best for your family, then you can follow your own value system. It's a hard one. This is really a very sensitive time, and the communication with our loved ones is going to be so important. And I want to say, do not text this type of conversation. This is something you want to do in person or over the phone.
No, that's good advice. If people just tuning in, we're talking with Jennifer Bohr-Cuevas. You could check out her website at jenniferbohrcuevas.com. That's BohrCuevas.com. And you could reach her through there if you want to continue the conversation or follow up with any of the subjects that we're talking about today. What do you do, Jennifer? Let's say you've decided to not get vaccinated, and that leaves you as the odd man or odd woman out on Thanksgiving. In my wife's family, for instance, she has, I think, three of her eight siblings are unvaccinated, and they don't want to get vaccinated. Let's say in her family, let's say there was a must-vax rule for Thanksgiving or Hanukkah or Christmas or whatever holiday people might be celebrating. What do you do if your values, your decision not to get vaccinated, conflicts with a house rule for one of these upcoming holidays? What are you to do? Do you grin and bear it and just get vaccinated, or do you kind of try and make an alternative plan with, you know, maybe just you and someone else for the holiday?
Well, one of the things that I'm also suggesting to my patients in my practice is being open to testing. So to get away from discluding their loved ones, would they be open to testing? But another thing that I'm recommending to people who are not choosing to be vaccinated at this time is to find like-minded people and perhaps put a gathering together with those people. So it may not be the most ideal answer, but if you don't want to be alone, then it is a way to gather sure. with people. And I have to say that the experiences of my patients are that finding these like-minded people is going in a very positive direction for them.
That's
and I
great.
Know of several people that are celebrating with people that aren't their family
Wonderful.
This year.
Wonderful. Jennifer, it is always a treat talking with you. What are you guys doing on Thanksgiving?
I am hosting.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
I look forward
Frank
to seeing you soon, Jennifer. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That is
Bye.
Jennifer Bor-Cuevas. You can, if you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. The one thing I would add is a little maybe common sense, right? Like the issue of if people have had COVID already and they've gotten over it, the overwhelming evidence suggests that they're not likely to give you COVID, especially if you've been vaccinated. Like, in my family, for instance, a lot of people are going to my cousin Kathy's, and there's cousins of ours that are coming in from Colorado, and none of them are vaccinated. And my sister Claudia was saying, oh, no, we shouldn't go. No, we weren't going anyway. I'm going to my mother's. But my sister Claudia was saying, oh, we shouldn't go. They're unvaccinated. We should make it so that we're only going with vaccinated people. And I said, Claudia, the three of them all had this virus. Why do you think it's wise to exclude them when the overwhelming evidence suggests that they're not likely to give you COVID? Since they already had the virus, since they have the antibodies, and since they're willing to take a negative test showing you that they don't have the virus, wouldn't that make more sense than excluding them from Thanksgiving? And I think she saw the folly of just excluding them for the sake of excluding them. But so if you're in a position to host and make house rules, then I think maybe that's something you think about. Hey, one thing that I think everybody acknowledges is now a problem is the issue of inflation. Inflation is out of control. They say it is as bad now as it has been at any time since 1981. And that is, quite frankly, pretty scary. So what can you do about it? Well, there's one strategy that has proven time and again to be a big, big winner, and that is investing in gold and other precious metals. Gold, silver, and other precious metals are a hedge against inflation. The less the dollar is worth, the more gold is worth. The worse inflation gets, the more gold is worth. So if you have your money in a traditional retirement account, think about rolling it in to a gold or a silver IRA. I just added some more gold to my portfolio yesterday because I have seen these inflation numbers. It is really sad. It's really disconcerting, but it doesn't have to be. If you can't beat them, join them. If you recognize the fact that inflation is here to stay, then recognize the fact that gold is the best way to beat back inflation. Gold should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio, and Legacy is the company that you can trust, Legacy Precious Metals, because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. So contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call them at 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit LegacyPMInvestments.com. That's LegacyPMInvestments.com. investments.com. We'll take your calls next. I'd love to hear from you. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. On Twitter as well, at Frank Morano. That's Frank Morano. Straight ahead.
We are New York on New York's Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions and my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to express my inner feeling and thankfulness for showing me the meaning of success.
That's Woman by John Lennon. If you ever want to know what bumper music we're playing, this morning I believe all the bumper music has been selected by our guest board op, Matt Blaze. You can just go to our Facebook group, Morano Radio Fans and Haters on Facebook, or if you want to just type into your web browser, facebook.com/groups/Radio Morano. I've also, somebody, George, I believe his name was, asked the question for a link to those six strategies on how to discuss politics with friends and family. So I've just posted those six strategies on there that I read to you before. So that's all in the Facebook group, facebook.com/group/Radio Morano. 800-848-9222. Gail on Staten Island has been patiently holding. Hello, Gail.
Hi, good evening, Frank. I'm listening to your show. It's good.
Oh, thanks.
I think liquor at a gathering starts to bring up people's, barter for speaking. I wouldn't suggest it. I would ask the question, though, if it's raised. When Schumer, because he's from New York, he's the majority leader also, and he stood in the streets of America and said on the day that Biden was elected, now we can change America.
Gail, would you do me a favor and turn your radio off?
Oh, wow. Okay. Is that better?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
To change it to what? Is this the America he wanted? He never stood in the streets when they were burning down buildings and rioting and looting and disrespecting our police, him, our loser mayor, and Nadler, that this is all where I live, and I won't go in the city anymore. It's a shame to bring my children, my grandchildren, to have the experience I had. Is this what is good about America? And until they tell me they know what bellwether means, gain of function, and they're learned scholars in the fundamental laws of our country, I'll get up and walk out of the room.
All right. So the best strategy for not having an angry conversation about this, you would say avoid liquor.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. That's fair. That's not going to be happening at my house. I can promise you that. 800-848-WABC. I find, look, I get it is true that booze can make you a little bit more likely to say something stupid and to not let something go. I find that a glass of wine or two can actually make you a little bit more relaxed and a little bit less likely to jump down someone's throat. And there's nothing that brings someone, two people together who may have opposite backgrounds, opposite ages, opposite ways of viewing the world. There's nothing that brings folks together more effectively, in my view, than getting drunk together. I honestly have found that getting drunk with somebody is a relationship pressure cooker. It does wonders to further the cause of harmony. It really does. But to each his own. That was Gail's suggestion there. Hey, you know what I do have a question about is garbage. So in my neighborhood, and I live in New York City, in my neighborhood, they pick the garbage up twice a week, Thursday and Sunday. Thursday and Monday. Monday they also take the recycling. So on Thursday, the landscaper came and he picked up the grass and leaves and so forth, and he did not pick up the garbage. The sanitation folks did not take the bags of garbage on our front, you know, in our front sidewalk area filled with leaves. They didn't take them. So I thought, that's strange. They took the rest of the garbage. Why wouldn't they have taken that? So come Monday, I still have that garbage out in the front of the house. Monday comes, they take the recycling. They take the garbage that I had in the garbage pail. But at first, they didn't take any of the garbage that was in the landscaping bags. And it was in the proper color bag. It was not as if they thought it was recycling or something. And then later on that same day, on Monday, maybe a few hours later, they came and took just one bag. Just one. They left the rest. So I'm trying to figure out, is this a result of the slowdown that we've been hearing about? Or is this personal? If anybody has any insight, let me know. And I'd be very curious to know what the deal is. Now, they're supposed to take the garbage Thursday. I realize that it's Thanksgiving, but I'm leaving the garbage out there until they take it. I mean, I had it out there for the proper days, so I'm leaving it out there. That's where I'm at. If you want to follow me on social media, I'd certainly appreciate it. You can follow me on Facebook, facebook.com/MoranoFan. And you can follow me on Twitter at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. And you can always email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. Those of you that are holding, I will get to your calls in just a moment. And some interesting information about why more young women are getting sterilized. I found this really interesting. And I think you will too. Stay tuned. I'll tell you about it. And then a little bit later, we're going to discuss the Kennedy assassination and the nexus with Marilyn Monroe with investigative journalist Mark Shaw. That's coming up at 3 o'clock. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Make sure you get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. My wife is with child. She could give birth any day now, any day. And my friend Danielle, also with child. She is due in, I guess, February. My friend Mary, my former coworker Mary, she is with child. She is due this week. Apparently, those three women, my wife, my friend Danielle, my former coworker Mary, those are the only three women in the country that are about to have children. Now, of course, I'm being somewhat facetious, but the trend line speaks for itself. Last year, the number of deaths exceeded that of births in 25 states. Well, you might say, okay, is that a lot or a little? That's up from 5 the year before. 25 states last year had more deaths than births. The year before, only 5 did. The marriage rate is at an all-time low, 6.5 marriages per 1,000 people. Millennials are the first generation where a majority are unmarried, about 56% in all. They're also more likely to live with their own parents, according to Pew Research, a very smelly polling organization. Previous generations They were also more likely to live with their own parents than previous generations were in their 20s and 30s. They also, the millennials are not having sex. The number of young men ages 18 to 30 who admit they have had no sex in the past year tripled between 2008 and 2018. Cities like New York, where young secular Americans flock to build their lives, are increasingly childless. In San Francisco, this is not a joke, this is not hyperbole, this is a fact. In San Francisco, there are more dogs than children. It used to be that people wanted to make babies, women especially, but also men. That was a healthy young person's default position, and our existence depended on it. We wanted to do other things, of course, and a lot of folks wanted to have a proper work-life balance. A lot of folks wanted to have a career and a baby. But now, for an increasing number, the question isn't how to have it all, it's why do it at all? And this has been covered. We covered this on the WABC Early News with Juliette Huddy yesterday. The New York Post has written about this, and a lot of other outlets have as well. This psychological reversal didn't just happen. It took place inside the hurricane of spiritual, cultural, and environmental forces swirling around us. Now, it is so interesting to me. You're seeing more and more young people choosing to get sterilized, get their tubes tied, or get a vasectomy in their 20s or their 30s because they are sure they don't want to have children. And 800-848-9222, the child-free have many reasons for not wanting babies: fear of pregnancy, fear of authority, fear of a pregnancy disorder, fear of postpartum depression. And Clay Rutledge, who is an existential psychologist at North Dakota State University who studied young people's attitudes towards the future, said there's a growing school of thought among 20-somethings that humans are the problem. It's not just that we've built factories and polluted the oceans and launched tons of garbage into space. It's there's something about us, our psychology, our chromosomal wiring, that makes it impossible for us to make things better. And according to Rutledge, they're saying that the future isn't a good investment. And if there's no future, why would you be anything but hedonistic? Why would you donate to charities? Why would you try to make the world better or care about human progress? So this is so interesting to me, and I think this is problematic. There are other people that don't think this is problematic. They think it's just fine that there are fewer children being born because they believe that this is going to lead to the people that are born getting more attention, having things like smaller class sizes and things like that, getting the best of everything, not having a scarcity of resources. I tend to think this is incredibly problematic. 800-848-9222. More adults choosing not to have children for a wide variety of reasons, but the number one reason is they don't want to. Some people want to have a good career, and this is something that I think is pretty alarming. You're seeing this play out in 25 different states. 44% of people age 18 to 49 say it's unlikely or not too likely that they'll have children. 3 years ago, that number was 37%. This is a trend that we've been seeing for years. The birth rate is declining. It was declining before the pandemic. We did not see a pandemic baby boom like some people were expecting. Instead, we saw a further decline during the pandemic. But this new data from Pew that's out this week includes something that has not often been reported. More people are saying they simply don't want to have children for no reason in particular. About 56% said they just don't want to have children, while 43% had some other reason. The two most common reasons include medical and financial concerns. Give me your reaction to this. What do you think about 56% of adults of childbearing age saying they don't think they're going to have children because they don't want to? 1-800-848-9222. You can comment on anything else we've covered this show as well. Mark Shaw joining me in the 3 o'clock hour. 1-800-848-WABC. Susan is in Brooklyn. Hello, Susan. Susan, I got you. All right, we'll move on. 800-848-WABC. Nate is in Union, New Jersey. Hello, Nate.
Hey, how you doing? Love your show.
Thank you.
Couple things. The thing about having a discussion, I always felt that if you have one person on side as a moderator, just to prevent anything from heating up.
That's a good idea. That's a role that I'd volunteer for. I like that.
Yeah. Also, I was listening to Ben Shapiro earlier today. He was talking about the whole not having kids thing. He said it was very interesting how, you know, all the incentives for having kids are, you know, for secular people are gone. You know, the last thing was maybe that your kids could take care of you. But now the government's saying, oh, when you get old, we'll take care of you, too.
Well, I know Ben, it's been a few years since I saw Ben, but last time I saw him, he had a few children, right? And he had just had one when I'd seen him last. He's got a few kids, and he was young when he started having children. But you do have, there are secular incentives. Like you get my wife and I are looking forward to the tax deduction for the year 2020. Marco Rubio also inserted that child care tax credit. So there are some financial incentives, aren't there?
Yeah. I'm talking about the long-term benefits that people think when they have kids, right? People, you know, for the reasons that you gave that, you know, what's the point?
All right. You know, well, what's your view, Nate? You have children. You want children. What's your story?
I do not. I'm still in college, but I definitely plan on having children.
All right. Well, so
I'm religious. So,
okay. Well, so so maybe that's part of the problem.
Rule.
All right. Thanks, Nate. For some reason, Nate and I talking over one another at the same time, but he seems like a great guy. And one of the many college-age listeners that we have. Thank you, Nate. 800-848-WABC. Anthony in Brooklyn. Anthony, what do you make of this data which shows that Americans aren't having children, and the reason they're not having children is because they simply don't want to?
Well, I don't know about the typical person why they don't want to have children, but I know why I don't want to have them. I have a mental illness that was passed down from my mother to me, and I don't think it'll be fair to do that to them. I won't do it to another life.
No, well, I think that's very noble. I'm sorry you've struggled with mental illness. If I can ask, what's the nature of your mental illness, Anthony?
It's extreme anxiety disorder and OCD, and it interrupted my life, and I just don't want to do it to another life.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I can certainly understand
that.
You
have nothing to be sorry about. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And anything else you want to add on this one, Anthony?
No, sir. I just wanted to say that. That's all. You have a great day.
Hey,
enjoy your show.
You too. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Appreciate it. 800-848-9222. Pat is in New Jersey. Pat, what do you make of this data which shows that people are not having children, and the reason they're not having children is because they don't want to?
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, Frank.
Sure.
The reason why they don't want to have kids these days is because they refuse to grow up, most of the young people.
Mm.
They don't want the responsibilities. They want to have the freedom that goes on with their young lives, and they just don't want to have been tied down. I see it, my kids are grown up. I have three children, but they they two of them have kids of their own, and that's a great thing.
Congratulations.
That,
congratulations.
Let's say you're right.
Let's say you're right, because I don't disagree with you necessarily. Let's say you're right. Why? Why do 25, 30-year-olds in the year 2021 not want to grow up and not want to do their part to keep the species going, whereas a 30-year-old in the year 2020 did want to go grow up and do their part to keep the species going? What happened between the year 2020 and 2021 to lead the current generation of young adults not to want to grow up, as you say, and not to want to have children, as the data suggests?
I think one of the reasons is also they're afraid with the current situation that's going on, whether it being health-wise or with the pandemic that's going on, and with the recent world events, you know, whatever it's happened in society, they're a little bit afraid and apprehensive about having kids. And they're afraid to bring kids in the world, which they're not really ready to tackle the challenges that I think they're going to present themselves.
Interesting.
Raising a family. You know, it's very difficult these days to raise a family as I'm used to, as I raised my family, my generation. I'm almost 60 years old, and things were much different when I raised my kids. Now, it's a whole different world, I think, especially this year with the pandemic. I think that had a lot to do with it.
Well, that is an interesting perspective, Pat. So people, young parents or potential parents, may view the world as so screwed up, they don't want to bring children into it, is what you're saying, more or less.
There is something that I observed and some of the conversation that I'm having with some of the younger folks. They are very afraid to, you know, even with the race issue that's going on, and whether, you know, you're black or white or green or blue, they are afraid to have a problem, you know, in mixing around. It's hard to put a, you know, to really comprehend, but from some of the things that I listen to in the conversation that I have, that is the world, the situation the world is going on these days, that's part of it.
Well, fair enough. Thank you, Pat. I appreciate that. You know, one of the people I'm trying to get on this show next week is Joe Lonsdale, who launched a podcast called The American Optimist. And his whole podcast, and I learned about him through John Stossel, his whole podcast is all about just being optimistic and the reasons there are to be optimistic. Because if you watch the media, whether you're watching liberal outlets like MSNBC or conservative outlets like Fox News, you think the world, as Bob Grant would say, you think the world is sick and getting sicker. When in actuality, there's a lot of great things happening in the world right now, and there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about the future of the world. And that, I don't think, is necessarily conveyed in the media. And if Pat is right, and I think he might be more right than wrong, if Pat is right that more young adults are refusing to have children because they can't bear to think about bringing children into the world as it exists now, then maybe if people start hearing about how great the world is right now in terms of where we are in a historical perspective, you know, you want to compare the amount of war that's happening in the country now and the world now as opposed to 1,000 years ago. It is much better now. The amount of slavery, the number of people that are oppressed now as opposed to 1,000 years ago, the number of people that right now have a basic quality of life equal to the middle class compared to 1,000 years ago. There are a lot of reasons to be optimistic. And I wonder if more young adults knew that, if more of them would be choosing to have children. I don't know the answer to that. If you do, give me a buzz. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Josh is in Rockland County. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Frank. First of all, congratulations on your baby.
Thank you.
Second of all, I think that people that have low self-esteem or are very into perfectionism will be even afraid of who said I'll be able to be a good father, and how are my kids going to judge me, or will I be able to give them the perfect life? And they think it's all up to them, so it becomes extremely stressful and frightening to have a baby, instead of being like, your father didn't give you a perfect life, but nobody has it, so they kind of like, you know what, I can't do it.
So you think because some of these young adults may have low self-esteem, they don't believe they have the ability to be a decent parent for a young person?
They believe that eventually either they're going to fail their kids or they're going to mess up their kids eventually, because they don't realize they could be great parents. They're just so afraid of what's going to happen. And maybe they'll have a kid that is way more smarter than them or something. They won't know how to deal. So they become like, they don't want to take the challenge even. They don't realize it's a day-by-day thing.
Well, hey, could be, Josh. It could be. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about this new data which shows that the number of young adults having children is once again falling to a record low. And the reason for that is not necessarily fertility problems or things of that nature, because they just don't want to. I've noticed that. You know, it's funny. Have you ever seen the movie Idiocracy? If you've never seen it, it's not a great movie. It's not a great movie. It's more of a great concept. And basically, the concept is that the smart people are not having children. And only, and again, it's a movie, it's fiction, it's not reality. But there are some elements of truth in this. Only the very dumb people are having children, and they're breeding with other very dumb people, and they're having child after child after child after child. And then, you know, they profile this super smart upper middle class couple, and they said, well, you know, at first we didn't want to have children because we wanted to travel. At first we didn't have children because we wanted to focus on our careers. Then we wanted to have travel. Then we wanted to do this. Then we wanted to have that. Then it just wasn't the right timing. And then by the time they're ready to start having children, they're both past the age of their fertility years. And then so their intelligent lines end. And then they profile some dumb people, and these dumb people are breeding like jackrabbits in this film, Idiocracy. And then you keep going and going and going, and then 100 years from now, or maybe, I don't remember, it's been years since I've seen the film, but many years in the future, the world is so much dumber. This is where the premise is fun. They take the most average guy in our time, and they put him in a time machine 100 years in the future, and the guy who has the most average intelligence is the smartest man on the planet 100 years from the time that he lived. It's very funny, the concept. Again, the implementation is a little off, but I do wonder if we are seeing that play out to some perspective. If the people that don't think twice about having children are people that aren't so bright, and then the people that are professionals or super smart, they find reason after reason to just wait. And I wonder what that means for the future of the species. I genuinely do. We'll continue with your calls in a moment. But whether you are somebody that is a child or an adult that's with child, something that you really need to think about is your digestive health. Because so much of what's important in terms of your health has to do with the gut, the bacteria that is in your gut. You want healthy gut bacteria. And that is where Life Change Tea comes in. Life Change Tea is a gentle daily cleanse that cleanses you from the inside out. It takes all the junk that's in your body, the heavy metals, the preservatives, the chemicals, and it gets it out. if you've ever had trouble being regular, if you've ever dealt with constipation, it helps you with that as well. And on top of all that, it's delicious. Comes in three great flavors. My favorite is the pomegranate. So if you haven't tried this stuff yet, there's never been a better time. Go to the website, getthetea.com, and you can order some. You can use the promo code Frank, and you'll get free shipping anywhere in the United States. It's getthetea.com, promo code Frank. Hey, if you're one of these perpetually childless couples, you don't have to worry about spending the money on a child. Spend the money on some life change tea. But just make sure you use the promo code Frank. Getthetea.com, promo code Frank. It is the tea that makes you go.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Tracks of My Tears, Miracle. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moran. I'm going to get to your calls in just a second. But first, I have to bring to your attention a story which I am hoping and praying isn't true. And look, I am a big animal person. I wouldn't say I'm an animal rights activist, but I am an animal lover. And I am a big animal fan. I love animals, love interacting with them. And when I hear a story about animal abuse, it really makes me want to cry, quite frankly. And I always liked animals. However, as much as I like animals, I have an addiction to seafood. I am a seafood killer. If I were a football player, my nickname would be Shrimp Killer, okay? Lobster, crab, grilled octopus. I love crustaceans and anything of that sort. I am a seafood fanatic. And look, how do I justify liking animals and enjoying eating them? I'm very conflicted about it, if I'm going to tell you the truth. And I have taken some solace in the fact that, I don't know, lobsters, crabs, octopi, octopuses, they don't exactly seem like advanced beings. Well, I read this article yesterday, which caused me a great deal of consternation. Octopuses, crabs, and lobsters are capable of experiencing pain or suffering, according to a review commissioned by the UK government, which has added the creatures to a list of sentient beings to be given protection under new animal welfare laws. So this report by experts at the London School of Economics looked at 300 scientific studies to evaluate evidence of sentience. And they concluded that cephalopods, such as octopuses, squid, and cuttlefish, and decapods, such as crabs, lobsters, and crayfish, should be treated as sentient beings. Vertebrates, which are animals with a backbone, are already classified as sentient beings in the UK in new animal welfare legislation that is under debate in the United Kingdom. And now this animal welfare science bill could cover lobsters, crabs, and octopuses. The bill, which is not yet law, will establish an animal science committee which will issue reports on how well government decisions are taken into account the welfare of sentient animals. So this report said that lobsters and crabs shouldn't be boiled alive and included best practices for the transport, stunning, and slaughter of decapods and cephalopods. So the report used eight different ways to measure sentience, including learning ability, possession of pain receptors, connections between pain receptors and certain brain regions, response to anesthetics or analgesics, and behaviors including balancing threat against opportunity or reward, and protection against injury or threat. And it found, quote, very strong evidence of sentience in octopods and strong evidence in most crabs. Now, for other animals in these two groups, such as squid, cuttlefish, and lobsters, they found the evidence was substantial but not strong. However, the report said these varying degrees of evidence reflected disparities in the amount of attention different animals have received from scientists. So I am going to look at this further, but I love lobster. I love eating octopus, love eating crab, and I don't feel great about eating them if they're sentient beings. So, I don't know. I'm curious what you think. 800-848-WABC. We're talking also as well about young adults not wanting to have children, and 56% of them say it's because they don't want to. 800-848-WABC. Let's chalk with the Mikes. Mike is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello there, Mike.
Hello, Mike from the Bronx. I think there's three reasons. It's fear of commitment, generational immaturity, and the end point of a hedonistic culture. With the fear of commitment, I think that goes hand in hand with the decline of marriage, because marriage is a commitment, and so is having children. Generational maturity. I think each generation since the World War II generation has taken longer to mature. And it's the end point of a hedonistic culture. Children, you know, get in the way, maybe financially or for a variety of reasons. But, you know, I mean, how many vacations can you take, or BMWs can you buy? I mean, it's you want to commit your life to something more than, a job, that when they have layoffs, they're committed to your career until they decide your excess baggage, whatever. It's I don't have children, and it's the biggest regret of my life, well, looking back.
Mike, what do you think caused that culture of hedonism among this generation of young people that you're describing? What led to it?
You know, the general society shift, like, to the anything goes mentality, to the there are no absolutes, you know, anything goes. There used to be a song, "Do it till you." One of the lines was, "Do it till you're satisfied, whatever it is." I think it's just part of how, you know, there's been a cultural change slowly over several generations.
Well, it is interesting, Mike, and I appreciate the call, and I appreciate you sharing your perspective, and I'm sorry you never got to have children. I can tell that's certainly a big issue with you. Perhaps that is something that Mike in Hoboken has a perspective on. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
First, I want to preface this whole conversation by saying you have a great show.
Oh, thanks.
Anyway, I think the problem now, I'm 70-something years old now. And I think the problem now with younger people, I have two younger sons, and I think it's, and they're fine. But I think most of the thing is they just care about themselves more than anything else. They're self-absorbed. And when I was growing up, the family was the most important thing, having children. I mean, I five generations have served in wars, including myself. And I don't think you find that stuff anymore, you know?
So, again, I'll ask you the same question I asked the other Mike. What changed? Why is this generation so much less selfless than the generation of 20 years ago?
maybe 40 years ago.
Well, no, but the data says that even 20 years ago, young people were still interested in having children.
I think it was mostly because people just thought they care about money, you know, making money, buying cars. I mean, I had expensive cars in my life, too, but, you know, it wasn't the most important thing I ever had. But people nowadays think that that's what they wear in their body, their clothes, their cars. That seems to be the most self-absorbing thing they do, you know. I can't really explain it, but.
All right. Well, I appreciate the perspective, Mike. Thank you. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Coming up in the 3 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the John F. Kennedy assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, and Marilyn Monroe's death, which many people believe was a murder, with Mark Shaw. He's going to be my guest for the hour. 800-848-WABC. Jeanette is in Manhattan. Hello, Jeanette.
Oh, hi. Yeah, Frank, as far as octopi and lobsters being sentient beings, of course they are. Sentient does not mean sapient. It doesn't mean conscious or aware. It just means they have feelings. They feel pain. And any animal that has a nerve ending feels pain. So I'm sure that lobsters are not having a good time when you throw them into the boiling water. So, of course, that should not be done. That is inhumane and brutal. All animals feel pain, which means they're sentient. Sentient just means, you look up the Latin roots, like, well, you know Italian, right? Sentire means to feel. Sapere, to know. So it doesn't mean they know anything. Octopi don't necessarily know anything, but they feel pain.
So
they are sentient beings.
Should I stop eating them?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you do eat octopi?
I do. Octopuses, yes.
You're kidding. Where do you get octopuses?
Oh, I mean, where I can list. So I had I was at this Japanese restaurant in Clark, New Jersey, where I had a wonderful grilled octopus one time at Patrizia's.
Wow.
Patrizia's, which is all over New York. There's 4 or 5 locations.
Ah.
They make a great grilled octopus. There's a number of great places where I get
octopus.
Is
it a common Japanese thing?
It's Japanese and Italian and a number of other things too. Yeah.
Right. So what part of the animal are you actually eating? Is it like the whole thing or just
you're
the,
eating
the arm?
Like tentacles from what it looks
tentacles.
Like.
Tentacles.
Yeah.
Ooh, I don't know. I would have trouble eating octopuses.
Well, I don't have trouble eating it physically. I am wondering if now I may have some trouble eating it ethically. 800-848-WABC. Jeff is in Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, to be specific. Hello, Jeff.
Good evening, sir. How are you this evening?
I'm hanging in there, Jeff. Hanging in there.
Okay.
Doing better than the lobsters are, I suppose.
Okay. Quick comment. If seafood had fur, it would be too cute and we wouldn't be able to eat any of it.
Well, so thank goodness they don't, I suppose.
I guess so. Now, as regards to not wanting to have children, I'm the proud father of a very wonderful daughter, and I wouldn't change her for anything in the world. But you know, I think people looking at these days is, kids are expensive. They're risky to have. You have to put them in daycare. You got to put them through school. The expense is ridiculous, and if you look at the expense of college, they're shying away from that.
So you think it's a dollars and cents thing?
I think so.
Okay. Well, now, and I get the cost of college, and I know the cost of college tuition has gone up so much more than the rate of inflation, but why weren't children expensive to have 35 years ago?
Well, number one, college was a lot cheaper back then. I know what I paid to go to Pitt back in my day, and I got a full college education for $3,600.
Yeah, well, no, again, I get the college aspect of it. But when it comes to all the other aspects of child rearing, feeding them, clothing them, paying the bills for whatever else children need, why was it so much less expensive 35 years ago than it is today?
Well, it may just come down to that one five-letter word, and it's can be applied just about everywhere. That word is GREED, and yeah, there you are.
Well, you might be right, Jeff. You might be right. 800-848-WABC. Julie is in Brooklyn. Hello, Julie.
Frankie, how are you? Good evening, Frankie. Listen, this child thing, listen, I got to, just from what I see, today it's a me world. Who wants to give? A lot, what do they know, a lot of young people, about suffering and sacrificing? And the other thing is, how many people got pride and say no and wanting to give their last dollar to bring it home to their wife and their kid to make sure that they're warm and fed? The other one, who's proud? Is anybody proud anymore? Does anybody stand up, this is my son, this is my daughter? And the other thing we have in this world today, too, we got very few men and women. We got a lot of boys and girls. Even older guys in their 50s have turned out to be boys and girls. Nobody wants to stand up and willing to sacrifice and give.
Well, Big Never Julie, I feel like I do hear a lot of people that have pride in their children. You feel like you don't hear that.
Well, I don't hear very much of that. And the other thing is, too, Frankie, when I got married with my first wife, I got married in 79, you didn't have to work 6 weeks for your rent.
Well, you're right about that. You're right about that. And what wife? You know, how many? What wife are you up to now? How many wives have you had total?
What's his name? Henry Fonda in a movie once quoted. He said, "A marriage once for any man is more than enough." But I've been married twice.
Twice.
And I fear nobody.
There you go. Not at the same time, I hope. You took them
consecutive. Listen, I don't want to get a bigamy kind of charge. Everything else I'm all right with.
thank you very much, Big Julie. 800-848-9222. Al is in Manhattan. Hello, Al.
Ms. Loreno, fantastic show as usual. And I want to wish you, your whole entire family, Rachel, your daughter, a very happy, happy, restful Thanksgiving.
Thank you very much. That's awfully nice of you. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent show. And with the kids today, you know, it's all different, you know. They got no music to listen to. I don't know if you can call that music today, what's going on. You know, when you and I were kids, guess what? You're 18, get a license. The people are 25, I might get a skateboard. I'm thinking about getting an Uber. You know what I'm trying to say? And they're on the phone 7 to 8 hours. So what happens? You get self-absorption. You know, when people got married, it was, you know, hey, let's consummate the marriage. They're on watching everything on the internet. They've been seeing it all and doing it all. And what happens is through peer pressure, nobody cares, like he said. I mean, I used to sit with my dog at a traffic light. I'd see at the traffic light, I kid you not, a girl open up the window and all her Burger King or McDonald's right there on the street.
I hate that. I've seen that too.
And then you're in a restaurant. Guess what? You'll hear sometimes cursing, effing this and effing that. And then, you know, you kind of like give a look like, you know, like, hey, I'm here enjoying a meal and the ambience, and I don't really want to hear F. So you give that look, you get death daggers. I've heard, and if people don't effing like the way I effing talk, then they effing shouldn't come in here. You know, like, wow. You know, I really hate to say it, but boy, that this poor generation, and it's like the gentleman said with the rent. 1960s, you know, people paying $100, $200. It was maybe 20%. And minimum wage, guess what? 1981 was $2.60. Way now, 40 years in the future, it's $7.60. You know? So that's one of the problems.
Well, that's a good point. And I get the financial aspect of it, Al. And I think you're right. I mean, and this is one of the reasons that I am so dead set against free trade and why I absolutely loved both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders on the trade issue, because one of the worst things that has happened to America over the last 35, 40 years has been the prevalence of free trade, in my opinion. I don't want to get into a whole economics discussion. I'll save that for the next time we have Alan Tonelson or Peter Navarro on. But there was a time in this country where you did not need two incomes to run a household. Now you do. And I do think there is an economic factor at play here. I got a Facebook message from a gentleman named John, and you can message me on Facebook as well if you want, facebook.com/MoranoFan. He writes, "Hi, Frank. The problem with young adults who don't want to have children is that they are lazy, selfish, and lack responsibility. They want to be taken care of instead of taking care of someone else." Now, I've now heard this from one, two, three, by my count, I think six people. Six people have all said some version of the same thing, that millennials today don't want to have children because they're selfish. Now, the follow-up question to that is, why are they selfish? Why is today's 25-year-old selfish, whereas in previous generations, in the year 2000, in the year 1990, in the year 1970, they were not as selfish? You know, you heard in the 60s and the 70s, you heard all about the Woodstock generation, free love, tune in and do all this stuff, the LSD and drugs. I mean, that seems like a pretty selfish generation. Why was that generation of selfish young people wanting still to have children, whereas this generation doesn't? That's what I don't feel like I've gotten an answer for. You know, the Woodstock generation, long hair, smoking marijuana all the time, listening to Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, going to Vietnam War protests, going to teach-ins. That generation was called selfish as well. So why is, if this generation is more selfish, why is that the case? If they're equally as selfish, why do today's selfish young adults not want children, but 20 years ago, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, they did? That's what I have not gotten an answer for. And I'd love to try and figure one out. 800-848-9222. See, my friend Rich is a very big believer in the generational theorists, Strauss and Howe. And I've been trying to get them on the show, Howe on the show, because Strauss is no longer with us. But William Strauss and Neil Howe are of the belief that all of America is a repeating 80-year cycle, and that every generation repeats, that you have a cycle, that the millennial generation is this generation's hero or civic generation, just like the GI generation was. Generation Xers are the nomad generation. The last nomad generation was the lost generation. The Generation Zers are the artist or adaptive generation. The last one of those was the silent generation. And Strauss and Howe believe, I don't subscribe to this, but my friend Rich does. He's all about this. Maybe one day we'll invite Rich in, and if we can't get Mr. Howe on the show, we'll invite Rich in to talk about this. But he believes that all of these generations share common characteristics. And he makes a pretty strong case. If that's the case, why are today's 30-year-olds not wanting to have children, whereas 80 years ago, they did? Is it simply a matter of selfishness? If so, why? 800-848-WABC. Jeff is in Queens. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Frank. Okay, in reverse order, guys. So many topics.
I know. It's one of those days. We're throwing a lot at you, Jeff.
I think on the left, okay, in reverse order, let's go back to some of them. You mentioned the lack of money. You know, now you pay, rent was once 20%, now it's 60% of your income. So that's why there's a possibility why people okay, I'm 64, no kids. Why? Money. Okay? I mean, I had two wives. Let's say that it could have worked out or not, but I'd say it would have been wrong for me to bring a child into this world based on my social work salary. Okay? All right. So now we could have sentient beings, Frank. Now we know what that means. I had a girlfriend once. She said she ate nothing. As a vegetarian, she wouldn't eat anything with a face on it.
Well,
okay?
Yeah, but does a lobster really have a face? I guess it does.
No, let's say it does. Okay, but anyway,
it's a weird face. Now, a crab does not have a face, really.
Yeah, that's a face, Frank. Come on, they got a. Oh, yeah. Come on.
Okay.
Look, take a second look. Then now, thanks to the hundreds of YouTube videos of hunters I've watched over the years, the subject often comes up, and the hunter, the guy who put the video up, points out excuse me, this is what it's like to know, you know, to eat the food that you kill is to be more honest than you who, you know, object to going to the grocery store and buying your steak in a case.
Well, so what does that mean for my purposes? That means I can only eat the lobster that I'm trapping myself?
No. It means that's a different point. In this case, it means if you're going to choose to eat, you know, you could love, Frank, I love animals as much as you do. I appreciate what you said about crying when you hear about the tortures against animals. I'm on the same page with you. But I eat meat. And I know a cow has died, so I can eat that meat. Okay, so you make that decision.
All right. Fair enough. So, okay. I'm no closer to getting guidance on whether. See, you know what I want? I want to be able to order a lobster and feel good about it, right? Like, you order a salad, you feel pretty good about the salad. You feel like it's good for you nutritionally, unless you're covering it with some unhealthy salad dressing. But you also feel that you're not killing anybody, that it's good. It's vegetables. You can always grow more lettuce. I want the same feeling of doing the right thing when I get a lobster or a grilled octopus. Because that Japanese restaurant in Clark, New Jersey that I went to, well, no, maybe it was Westfield, New Jersey, one of the two. It was really just great. That grilled octopus was just out of this world. I tried to get my wife to go back there this weekend, but we made other plans. And it's not to be said, not to say we don't have a lot of other great grilled octopus places near me. Hey, 800-848-9222. We'll continue with your calls in just a minute. Mark Shaw joining me at 3 o'clock. But here's something that you can feel good about. Gold. You know, I got a call one time during one of the Ask Frank Anything hours of a guy that called in and said, when you see your money in gold and you have possession of that gold and you can look at it and it's tangible and it's not sitting on a spreadsheet somewhere and you can actually see the value of what you have, that's such a great feeling. And I believe that because gold has always been, for thousands of years, going back to before the Roman Republic, gold has always been valuable. Gold has always been an important measure of wealth. But now that inflation is out of control, now that the dollar is not even pegged to the price of gold, the more inflation gets out of control, the more gold is going to be worth. So if you've got your money in a retirement account, a conventional retirement account, be it a 401k, a Roth IRA, or a conventional IRA, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA. And if you do it, you should think about doing it with legacy precious metals. Gold really should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio. It's a part of mine. I just bought some more yesterday. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased information based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals. Give them a call, 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. You can also go to the website, legacypminvestments.com. You can request some free information on there. And if you do it, it's going to ask you where you heard it. Tell them you heard it from me, Frank Morano, legacypminvestments.com. Request the information for free. Tell them you heard it from me, Frank Morano.
77 WABC.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Feeling better now that we're through. Feeling better cause I'm over you. I learned my lesson and left a scar.
You're no good, Linda Ronstadt. That's what she said to Jerry Brown when she kicked him out the door. Am I right? I think they are actually still friends. But This is The Other Side of Midnight, taking your calls at 800-848-9222. We're on Twitter at Frank Morano. Hey, you know what the first thing you'll see if you go to my Twitter? It is a plea from me to Elon Musk asking to be sent to space on the next SpaceX flight so I can be the first radio talk show host to broadcast from space. How cool would that be? I mean, yeah, go to space and do a show from there. You could call me in space. That'd be so neat. So if you want to help me get attention to that, please go to my Twitter, at Frank Morano, that's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O, and retweet that. Because I'm hoping that if we get thousands and thousands of tweets, that that will get Elon Musk's attention and he'll let me go to space. So far, we have 13. I'm hoping by next hour, maybe we'll get 14. 800-848-9222. Christine is in the East Village. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Frank. I wish that I could relieve your conscience as it deals with octopi, but I can't because they are intelligent beings. They're capable of love, and they can open cans. They're escape artists. They think they solve problems. I was once grabbed by an octopus down in Cozumel many years ago. I felt this tender caress move around my leg. Ooh. About up to my knee. And it felt like a human being. It was weird. And I felt this kind of love. And I jumped up in the air and I realized that it was an octopus. And nearby were some kids playing, and the octopus saw the kids and let go of me. The arms all went out, ah, and then flopped back down into the ocean or the sea. And then it started turning all different colors, which was a sign of anger. Yellow and pink, I think it was blue, and it swished away in anger. And it, as it swished away, it let loose a whole bunch of black ink, which is, yeah, they hide behind the ink.
So needless to say, Christine, you do not eat octopus.
I have eaten it, but I prefer not to.
Interesting.
Not because I think it's okay to eat meat as long as you're not cruel and you don't do anything excessive to injure what you're eating. But it's not my chosen food. It is delicious. I lived in Spain for many years, and they eat a lot of it there. But it does. It is a sentient being, and it is capable of emotion.
Well, thank you, Christine. Hopefully, when when that you were caressed and touched by that octopus, you did file the appropriate complaint in a timely manner to have that octopus brought up on charges under the Me Too movement. Because if they are that sentient, these octopuses should not be caressing women without their consent. All right. All right. Hey, we're going to talk about Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy next. If you want to continue to hold, you're welcome to. But I'm going to talk with Mark Shaw about all this stuff coming up in just a moment. Until next hour, keep asking questions.
Red Apple Media is proud to celebrate 100 years as one of America's most influential radio stations and New York's first. WABC. And WLIR-FM Hampton Bays.
From around the world to around the block, this is a WABC 77 Second News Update.
Good morning, I'm Molly Fichter. The House committee investigating the Capitol riots is issuing five new subpoenas this week, focusing on allies of former President Trump, including Roger Stone and Alex Jones. Investigators are intent on learning the details and planning of the rallies that drew Trump's supporters to Washington on January 6th. You can hear an exclusive interview with Roger Stone from the Cats at Night show at WABCradio.com. Governor Kathy Hochul is getting a look at the site of the second phase of the Second Avenue subway expansion, extending the line from 96th to 125th Street in Harlem. Hochul on Tuesday pledged to get the next phase underway in 2022, calling on the Biden administration to approve the MTA's application for federal funding after a years-long delay the state officials pin on former President Trump's administration. The list of fatalities in the Wisconsin Christmas parade tragedy has grown to 6. Authorities say an 8-year-old boy has died after suffering serious injuries when an SUV rammed into a crowd. The judge set bail for Daryl Brooks at $5 million. Brooks is charged with intentional homicide in 5 deaths. More charges are likely. More than 60 people were hurt in the rampage. It is 31 degrees and clear in Manhattan. This has been 77 seconds of news from the 77 WABC studios. Remember, the news never stops at WABCradio.com.
77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Good morrow, everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I am Frank Morano. Thanks for listening to our program. Well, this week marked the anniversary of the day that some people say was the day that the United States lost its innocence. Meanwhile, if you look at the underlying motivations and factors behind that incident, it's clear that there might not have been very much innocence to begin with. I'm talking about the John F. Kennedy assassination. It was November of 1963 when the whole world changed, or at least when the American public became aware that the whole world changed. Well, a gentleman who has been writing about this for years, studying this from 500 different angles, from perspectives that people can only dream about, is Mark Shaw. He is an attorney, an investigative journalist, and author of the new book, Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. I am thrilled that he's agreed to join me for the hour. Mark, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Frank. I'm a big admirer of yours. You're a man of the truth and have a lot of respect for you. So thanks for having me on the program.
The pleasure is all mine. Now, so much of the challenge in interviewing you is there's so much great content in this book, and I can't recommend it enough for people. It's called Collateral Damage. People should check it out. The trick is finding out where to begin, because there's so many great places to begin in terms of chronological order. But I think where I want to begin is in terms of your interest in this subject. And you sort of took an unorthodox approach to this subject, the subject of the John F. Kennedy assassination at first, and then the ripple effect with Dorothy Kilgallen and Marilyn Monroe. You were an attorney, very well regarded criminal defense attorney. People have seen you as a legal analyst on television analyzing some of the biggest criminal cases in the country. How does a criminal defense attorney and a legal analyst go from that to being one of the most prolific authors on all of these assassinations and murder plots?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we never know where life is going to lead us. If somebody would have told me when I was sitting in my dorm room in 1963 at Purdue University on my way to a class, and I heard the terrible news that President Kennedy had been shot in Dallas. If somebody would have told me that, you know, I would go on years and years later to really study and research that investigation, I would have told them that would have made no sense, because I really didn't have that much interest in it. I was terribly sad, angry, as many people were. I think you put it well. Maybe our country lost its innocence then. But later on, you know, after my years as a criminal defense lawyer and then a television legal analyst and everything, I started writing my books. That began in 1992 when I wrote about the Mike Tyson trial that I covered for ABC and CNN, and then on through my television days and everything. And I started writing my books, biographies about different subjects and things. And then everything changed, Frank, in about 1996 when Melvin Belli, who was, maybe your audience will remember, he was this a very famous lawyer in San Francisco, represented the Rolling Stones and Muhammad Ali and all of those people, when he died in 1996. And the reason that that's a marker is because I had practiced law with Melvin Belli in the 1980s in San Francisco, shortly after I became a California attorney. So I knew him, and when he died, I thought, you know, this is a good subject for a biography. There really hasn't been one written. And so I started to look into Melvin Belli's life and times and his representation of Jack Ruby. And what I found out was that, you know, Belli really had an affection for the mafia back then. I didn't know that when I practiced law with him, but he did. His main client at the time was Mickey Cohen, a Los Angeles gangster. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, I'm finding out just what I knew, that Belli was basically a personal injury lawyer. How in the world, and I think you would have been curious about this as well, did he become Jack Ruby's lawyer? And so I started looking into that, and what I discovered was that it looked to me like that it was meant to be, that he even may have had advance notice of the JFK assassination, which I have proven now in collateral damage. And the reason that that happened is because his affiliation with the mafia, because you have to then quickly go back, as I did, after I found out these connections with Belli and his very weird defense of Jack Ruby, insanity defense that made no sense, and also that he wouldn't let Ruby testify.
If you would, Mark, I'm sorry, if you would just, because we are talking about events that happened over 60 years ago, refresh the audience's recollection of what went down with respect to the prosecution or of Jack Ruby. What was his defense, and how did things go down after he killed Oswald?
Well, you know, in November 22nd, yesterday, 58 years ago, Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested for allegedly shooting the President of the United States, President Kennedy. And then he, you know, was sought after. And finally, a day or two later, Jack Ruby entered the Dallas Police Department basement. And he said he just happened by there. I've proven that that's not the case because of some eyewitness testimony I have. But he shot Oswald, and everybody remembers that on television. So there wasn't any question, although some people with these crazy theories have said, well, that wasn't really Jack Ruby, or that really wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, or whatever. But the television footage shows that he shot him. Well, he was immediately arrested and then jailed, and then his trial would have begun in March of 1964. And so what I was interested in is focusing on Belli, and I went back to look at certain events that had happened prior to 1963, because I wondered about this whole mafia connection between Belli and Mickey Cohen and other mafioso and all of that. And when I started doing that, then that just tumbled out all of the evidence that has led to actually five books about the JFK assassination. The first one, The Poison Patriarch, about Joe Kennedy and the 1960 election, and then the best-selling The Reporter Who Knew Too Much about Dorothy Kilgallen, Denial of Justice about Dorothy Kilgallen, and the most recent book, Collateral Damage. So I just kept collecting information as I went along, and that culminates now in my latest book.
All right, so you were saying you practiced law with Melvin Belli. He was essentially a personal injury attorney, but came to represent Jack Ruby, and he had was sort of a mob buff, a mob groupie, and you actually wrote a book about Melvin Belli called King of the Courtroom.
That's right, and you know, Belli was a very confusing figure to write about, because he had actually written two autobiographies, and they conflicted. He was really wasn't much of a man of the truth. I didn't have a great deal of respect for him when I practiced law with him and all of that. But what I came to find out was that he was kind of on call. He knew all of those mafioso and everything, and so when Ruby shot Oswald, in fact, I have an eyewitness who was right there. That Belli said, well, I guess if Oswald's dead, I'll have to represent Ruby. And the way you connect that in, Frank, is you go back to the 1960 election, because Joe Kennedy knew they were going to lose that election to Richard Nixon if they didn't win Illinois and West Virginia. Joe calls in his friend Frank Sinatra, who has connections, as Joe Kennedy did, with some of the mafia underworld, some of the magic names back there. Frank Costello, Santo Traficante, Sam Giancana in Chicago, and one particular mafioso, Carlos Marcello, in New Orleans. And they helped them win that election. Well, the deal was, you help us win the election, and then we'll leave you guys alone when we get in the White House. But right away, after they won, I had a witness, a very viable, credible witness, a newspaper man who was one of the founders of USA Today, who was right there when JFK ordered Bobby Kennedy to, Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy Attorney General. Now, Bobby hated those guys from some racketeering hearings in the 50s. And so, predictably, he went after them, especially Marcello. And as you get to the end of 1963, before JFK died, and it's very logical and common sense regarding motive, Bobby Kennedy had deported Marcello, and he had also charged him with racketeering. And Marcello isn't a dumb guy. In fact, I found a new FBI file that shows his empire was worth probably $30 or $40 million at the time, and this was in $1960.
Wow.
So he was threatened by Bobby Kennedy's actions, and he said to himself, well, I've got to do something, but if I kill Bobby Kennedy, who I detest, then JFK will come after me with everything the government has. But look, if I kill JFK and orchestrate that death, Bobby Kennedy will be powerless. And that's exactly what happened. They never went after those guys again. Bobby resigned as attorney general and all of that. And so I went back to that 60 election, and then I landed on the biggest, the biggest element of my research that led to the latest three books, and that's my introduction to Dorothy Kilgallen.
Dorothy Kilgallen, and I know we spoke about this when we discussed your book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, and when we discussed the follow-up, Denial of Justice, and the work that you've been able to do on these two books, and what's happening now with the NYPD, which I hope we can touch upon, is amazing, and it really is a testament to journalism at its most effective. But for people that haven't read those two books, for people that haven't heard our prior discussions, Dorothy Kilgallen was one of the most influential media figures, not only in New York, but in the whole country in the 1960s. She was not only a regular featured panelist on to Tell the Truth confused.
That's right.
But she was also a radio talk show hostess on WOR. She had a widely read column. Dorothy Kilgallen, what was her interest in investigating the Kennedy assassination and the death of Marilyn Monroe?
Well, we'll get to Marilyn in just a little while, but it's easy to see, and a lot of people miss this, Frank. I'm not the most proficient researcher that ever lived. Really, I'm not. I'm not trying to be humble there. All of this material was out there, but people missed it. And even today, anytime I hear about a new book written about JFK or assassination or even Marilyn Monroe, I first of all say, well, look, did they follow the research of Dorothy Kilgallen? And if they didn't, then in my opinion, the book is worthless, because she is the most credible journalist reporter to have ever covered the JFK assassination. And why did she do so? Because, as you mentioned, she had a syndicated column in the New York Journal American, syndicated to 200 newspapers across the country, radio show listened to by a million people, What's My Line TV star. I mean, she had it all. The New York Post called her the most powerful female voice in America, and a good friend of hers was John F. Kennedy. And the way that that happened is that she took her young son, Kerry, to the White House. Pierre Salinger set it up so that they could meet the president, and he fussed over the little boy, gave him a PT-109 pin, praised him for bringing letters from his third-grade class, and, you know, you can just imagine a little boy. I think he was like eight at the time. And so when he died then, and JFK had been to a couple parties at Dorothy's home as well. When he died, I mean, she was just flabbergasted. And the first thing that she knew, she said in her columns, was, wait a minute, this whole Oswald alone thing doesn't make any sense to me. And what did she do? She flew to Dallas. She was at the Jack Ruby trial in March 64, and the only reporter to have interviewed Jack Ruby at that trial. And what I found out then, that connected in Belli, the mafia, Marcello, and everything, is that she interviewed Ruby, and what did she do? Well, she didn't go to Washington, D.C. and look into Lyndon Johnson or the military complex, go to Miami and look into the Cubans, any of those kind of things she didn't do. She went to New Orleans. That's where Marcello's empire was, which had stretched to Dallas. So she researched him, and I've been able to prove in my books that Dorothy connected Marcello, Jack Ruby, and Lee Harvey Oswald, and I've lately come up with a couple of accounts that confirm all that. And so what did she do after she was in New Orleans? She went back to New York, and she made the same mistake that Marilyn Monroe would have made about 3 years earlier in 1962 when she died. She became a blabbermouth. And she kept telling everybody that would listen, I'm going to crack the JFK assassination case wide open. If the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it could cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I've bought a gun. And I'm writing a book for Random House, and it's going to expose Marcello as orchestrating JFK assassination and J. Edgar Hoover for covering it up. So in November of 1965, this is 3 years after Marilyn died, 2 years after JFK died, they died within 40 months of each other, the three of them. She was found dead in her Manhattan townhouse apartment in a bedroom she never slept in, wearing her makeup, eyelashes, and hairpiece that she never wore to bed. Very unusual circumstances, a staged death scene. But when the police got there, they actually saw an empty bottle of Seconal. They immediately determined that she had overdosed, another celebrity overdosing. And that was the conclusion that the medical examiner gave to the media, that she died of an overdose, although they said circumstances undetermined.
Was Dorothy known to have been a regular drug user at the time?
Not at all. And, you know, it's amazing to me. One of the relevance of the things that I've presented this year in the Collateral Damage book is, again, to focus on the fact that not enough questions were asked back in the early 1960s, not about Marilyn's death, as we'll talk about, not about JFK's, not about Dorothy's. And it teaches us, and in this day and age, we need to ask more questions and everything. No evidence of that at all. On the Cats Roundtable program on WABC with our friend John, he had on at the same time with me Dr. Michael Bodden. And I said to John, I want to ask Dr. Bodden about something. So Matt Wanning, who runs that program, as you know, set it up. And he put Bodden on at the same time. And I said, well, Dr. Bodden, it's Mark Shaw. And I said, I'm sure you realize and remember that your name is on Dorothy Kilgallen's autopsy. And there was silence. He said, what? And I said, yes, sir. I said, I have it right in front of me. You signed the autopsy. And I said, you know, and then that autopsy said she died of an overdose, and you guys went ahead and gave that material out to the media and immediately said, well, we should have never done that because, Mark, we really didn't know what happened to her. And I was just flabbergasted. And if I wasn't such a nice guy and I didn't want to embarrass John, I would have used a lot of dirty words that I wanted to say to him, because that them doing that and calling it an overdose of drugs ruined her reputation. And I must say, until I wrote The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and cleaned up that reputation, she was a forgotten woman. So that was the Dorothy Kilgallen situation, and I can
That's
tell you
That's
right
really
now,
wild, the fact that Dr. Michael Bodden, whose signature is on the autopsy itself, is acknowledging that at the very least his handling of this was an error.
It sure was, and I think John was shocked. I think we both were. The people that were on the show that day were, and he kind of then backed away a little bit in terms of his responsibility and all of that, but I was really upset with him, and that information is all in Collateral Damage, and it really still bothers me today that happened. And so, you know, that was enough for me, though, Frank. I'd written the Melvin Belli book, The Poison Patriarch, about Joe Kennedy, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, the bestseller about Dorothy, Denial of Justice, which was the follow-up book where I exposed the Jack Ruby trial transcripts, showing that Jack Ruby actually had planned to be there at the Dallas Police Department when Oswald was being transferred. The police helped him get into the basement. He acted like a reporter. And that whole part about the police with Ruby was confirmed by Dorothy Kilgallen in one of her columns that I have in Collateral Damage. But I was done. I didn't want to go any further. And yet, people kept asking me, these people. I probably have about 3 million views, YouTube views of my presentations, interviews about my books, and all of these emails that I get and everything, they said, well, Mark, is there a connection between the deaths of Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and JFK? And I didn't think there was, but I'll tell you exactly what happened. The first thing that I found gave me pause to say, wait a minute, I need to look into this.
So you have the two books on Dorothy Kilgallen. You're able to actually get the NYPD to reopen a look into her murder, which is, I think this is, for a case of this magnitude, going back decades, I think this is the only instance that I'm aware of where the NYPD has done something like this. I'm sure they have done it before, but it's the only it's the only instance that I'm aware of this happening. So then how does the book with Marilyn Monroe come to be, and how does Robert Kennedy get involved with this? And I imagine you were exhausted, not only in terms of physically exhausted, but mentally and spiritually exhausted from doing two full books covering Dorothy Kilgallen and John F. Kennedy. Why then Marilyn Monroe, where? How does that then take place?
Well, let's go back just a minute. It was actually Cyrus Vance Jr., the district attorney in New York City. New York Post did a big article about the fact that they, after I had bugged them and sent letters and everything, that they would investigate Dorothy's death. And so they did, Frank, for 8 months. I flew back and met with the detective in the DA's office. I gave them all the evidence, the books, everything that I possibly could. And for 8 months, they looked into it until they called me one day, and the assistant district attorney said, Mark, this is taking too much time and too much money and all of that. And besides, we really can't figure out what happened. We don't think anything really happened to Dorothy Kilgallen, which made me want to throw up. And then he said, and besides, we don't know who did it, which was completely contradictory, meaning that they knew that Dorothy had been murdered. So that went by the wayside. I filed some Freedom of Information Act things, no luck. And then in 2019, I flew to New York and met police commissioner, Dermot Shea, shook hands with him. The picture is in Collateral Damage. He told me he was going to investigate Dorothy Kilgallen's death. He introduced me to a detective who was going to do that. And then, unfortunately, when I got back here and tried to contact the detective, they wouldn't let me do that. So that was really disappointing. Then we had the pandemic, and after the pandemic in this past May, I got back in touch with them and asked them what they were going to do. Got a wonderful phone call from a Sergeant Panzarella with the Cold Case Squad who said he was going to look into Marilyn's death, and yet I haven't heard any more from him. So that's where that stands. With regard to Marilyn, there were two documents that made a lot of difference. First of all, as far as their friendship went, I found a photograph of Marilyn and Dorothy on the set of a movie at 20th Century Fox in 1960, and they're looking there together, and obviously they were friends. The second one that really intrigued me, I think it would have you as well, being curious, I'd always wondered about whether Marilyn Monroe actually committed what they called probable suicide. And so I was a little bit dubious of that, and so I wondered what her mental state was before that happened. Remember, it happened on August 4th, 1962. JFK is November 63. Dorothy is November 65. Within 40 months of each other, these young people died. Marilyn at 36, JFK at 46, Dorothy at 52. So I found this this document that Dorothy had written, just as she had written a number of articles diffusing the Oswald alone theory, crazy theory that lasted a day, which I've completely destroyed in my books, and Dorothy did as well through columns. She wrote a column about Marilyn. And to paraphrase it, basically she said, Marilyn Monroe, don't believe what you've heard about Marilyn. She's on the upswing. She's going to Hollywood parties. She has an offer for a Broadway play and more films and all of that. And she is in the romantic area. She has gotten involved with a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio, and that was Marilyn's second husband, the Hall of Fame New York Yankee outfielder. Mm. And so I said to myself, well, wait a minute. This does not sound like a woman who would commit suicide at all. And so the first thing I usually do when I investigate these murders, in fact, I have it on my wall. It says the dead cannot cry out for justice. It is the duty of the living to do so for them, and that's my job. I want to be JFK's voice and Dorothy's and Marilyn's, and so I went to the autopsy. Frank, if you want to cover up a murder, just falsify the autopsy. It was false in JFK's death. Dr. Cyril Weck, who's my expert, forensic expert, said the JFK autopsy was a joke. In Dorothy's case, as we talked about, it was completely bogus. And I went to Marilyn's death, and in the morning after she died, the certificate of death said it was a drug overdose. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the autopsy said it was a suicide. And so that made me really curious here, and I said to myself, okay, well, if Marilyn Monroe did not commit suicide, and it wasn't accidental, then it must have been murder. Who are the chief suspects? Who's this bigger name than Joe DiMaggio? And I landed on who? John F. Kennedy.
And by the way, just no note in that purported suicide of Marilyn Monroe, right?
None at all. Mm-hmm. None at all. And she just bought a home. She just had a dog. She was going to, I found out that she was going to remarry Joe DiMaggio just within a few weeks of her death time. And so she was doing just fine. So it didn't make sense. So I went to the autopsies and then I looked into JFK, but they had a short affair, but that was over when Joe Kennedy said no more, no more. So I looked at the next biggest name, and who was that? Robert F. Kennedy. And so I wondered, most people remember JFK and Marilyn, Frank, but they don't remember Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn because it was so covered up back then and the right questions weren't asked. And so the first thing that I found was a letter from Jean Kennedy Smith, the brother Kennedy's sister, that said to Marilyn in a letter, "I hear you and Bobby are the new item, exclamation mark. When he comes back to the East Coast, please come with him." So that really made my ears, perk up that something was going on there. And I found a CIA document that was distributed in just a couple days before Marilyn died. And the second page of that document, I want to talk about the first page in a little while, but the second page said, "Bobby Kennedy has been having a torrid love affair with Marilyn Monroe to the extent that he has told her he will divorce Ethel Kennedy and marry Marilyn." And so that really got me on the trail of Bobby Kennedy, and I started to figure out, wait a minute, was he in L.A. During the months prior to when Marilyn died? And right away, I was able to find out. He wrote a book called The Enemy Within about the mafia, about their sleek slip back hair and their fancy suits and their jewelry and all these things, making fun of them. They giggled like little girls, he said, and all this kind of stuff. And you can't mess around with those guys, but that's what he said. And he was in Los Angeles in '62, early '62, trying to get a movie made at 20th Century Fox. So I knew he was there. So I wondered, all right, now how do I connect Marilyn with him if he's not even in L.A. on that particular day? And then I came across, because he said he was in San Francisco giving a speech and doing other things, and then I came across a couple pieces of evidence that are laid out like a prosecutor would in collateral damage. I basically resolved these three true crime murder mysteries, and I lay it out because here's the evidence you would present to a jury. You know, Bobby, you say you were in San Francisco. Well, just a second. I have a ledger over at 20th Century Fox on August 4th, 1962, that says that you, at 10:50 in the morning, you landed at a heliport there in a helicopter along with Peter Lawford, and the man who was there documented that, and, you got into a limousine. And then, Bobby, if that's not enough, there's a Beverly Hills Police Department officer, the most decorated at the time, Lynn Sherman was his name, Lynn Franklin, who said that later that afternoon and early evening, he stopped a limousine on Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles going 75 and a 50, and he pulled it over, and when he got to there, he looked at the driver and said, "Well, Pete, what are you doing?" It was Peter Lawford, who was a good friend of his. He looked in the back seat, and there was Bobby Kennedy. And in the front seat beside Peter Lawford was Marilyn Monroe's psychiatrist. So I proved that that Bobby was in Los Angeles. I was able then to prove that here's what happened. The weekend before Marilyn died, she was at an event up in near Lake Tahoe at a hotel up there. Frank Sinatra was there. Peter Lawford was there. Other dignitaries were there and all of that. And they got to talking about Marilyn and Sam Giancana, a mobster, was there, all these people. And Marilyn got the idea that they'd invited her because they were going to pass her around, as she said, like a piece of meat. And she just was so upset with it, she started screaming, according to an account that I have, and said, I've had it with you guys. I've had it with the Kennedys. And this is where she became a blabbermouth that put a target on her back. She said, I'm going to the media with this. Well, all of that material to me, I really had to try to confirm that it happened, that Marilyn had threatened to do all that. And it was the first part of that CIA document that I mentioned to you in August of 1962, just before she died. And basically the first page said that there had been two wiretapped conversations that the CIA knew about. One was Dorothy Kilgallen and a very close friend of hers, an antiques dealer in New York City. And that particular overheard conversation, if you can imagine this, Frank, it connected all three subjects with their obsession with UFOs.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that. In fact, we actually just have to pause real quick
to
take a quick break, and I want to ask you about that. I also want to delve a little bit more into what Dorothy's actual theory was behind the motivation for the John F. Kennedy assassination, and how that led to Robert F. Kennedy. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Mark Shaw. We've been lucky enough to benefit from his wisdom before. He's one of the most thought-provoking journalists I've ever read. His latest book is Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the John F. Kennedy assassination. If you want to check out his previous interview with John Catsimatidis this week, in which you could hear that one-on-one with or back and forth with Dr. Michael Bodden, you can check that out at WABCradio.com. Certainly worth listening to as well. Before we continue, though, I do want to take a moment to tell you about what I am planning on doing after the holidays to lose some weight and maybe what you can do, too. You've heard me talk about Mitch Suss and his medical weight loss center in Westchester County, the Skinny Center. After researching other weight loss programs and seeing how my colleague Greg Kelly is looking and feeling, I decided that this program is the one for me. I can't wait to go through their exclusive lab testing that tells you why you can't take off this weight. Thanksgiving is coming. It's going to be here tomorrow. And I am starting the program right after the holidays. Hopefully you'll join me as well. Until then, Mitch sent me a product that is helping to control my appetite and stop me from overindulging and gaining another 10 pounds during the holidays. It's called Skinny Spritz. I'm completely amazed by this. It's great. Few spritzes and your appetite is, boom, totally suppressed. Mitch told me their patients use Skinny Spritz to help adhere to the program. The hardest part is getting started, and this product gives you a jump start. Call the Skinny Center today. Write this number down, 914-703-4811, or go to theskinnycenter.com. That's theskinnycenter.com. We'll continue with Mark Shaw straight ahead.
WABC.
When you support City Harvest, you do more than just provide hundreds of millions of pounds of food to millions of hungry New Yorkers. You feed hope for a kid up in Parkchester. You feed confidence for a first-in-her-family Queens College freshman. You feed community for folks in Canarsie Park. You feed compassion for retired Staten Island nurses who continue to serve. You feed strength for office workers in Manhattan. When you support City Harvest, you feed good. Support us at cityharvest.org.
Gold and silver prices are at an all-time high. If you have any gold, silver, or platinum coins, bullion, Franklin Mint items, diamonds, jewelry, art, antiques, paintings, French furniture, any Tiffany items, sterling flatware, Judaica, oriental rugs, older baseball cards, sport and entertainment memorabilia, watches, especially better watches such as Rolex, Patek Philippe, Vacheron, Tiffany, IWC, Cartier, Breguet, Omega, Breitling, and Bulgari, just to name a few. They will buy them at all the highest cash prices
in any condition, even broken. They also need any designer jewelry, such as Cartier, Tiffany, Buccellati, Van Cleef, Harry Winston, and Bulgari. Now is the time to cash out at the world-famous APR 57 Gallery on 57th Street in New York City across from Carnegie Hall. They can also come to your home and do certified insurance appraisals. So if you have anything of value, call them for a free appraisal and high cash offer at 212-246-2000. That's 212-246-2000. Or toll free at 800-772-0054.
With Cousin Brucey.
Hey, cousins, it's the Saturday night rock and roll party. With me, I'm your Cousin Brucey. That's this Saturday. Go on the air at 6 o'clock. Right here on Music Radio 77 WABC. You can also hear Cousin Brucey on WABCRadio.com.
77 WABC, All-American.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We are joined for the hour by Mark Shaw, investigative journalist, attorney, author of the new book, Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen, and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination. He's written multiple books, I think about five in all, about the John F. Kennedy assassination. It seems appropriate this week, since we're spending a lot of time looking back at what happened at that fateful day in Dallas in November of 1963, to look at the intersections that it might have had with the Robert Kennedy death, the death of Marilyn Monroe, and yes, even the death of journalist Dorothy Kilgallen. Mark, you mentioned a few minutes ago that the three of the subjects that we're talking about here, Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and John F. Kennedy, all had an interest in UFOs. What was the nature of that interest?
Well, what the CIA document talks about is each one of them having such an interest. I knew about Dorothy's because she had gone actually to a UFO convention to cover it in Great Britain, and she wrote articles about it, which are in Collateral Damage. So I knew about her. I didn't know about Marilyn, and there was some information in that CIA document that she was interested as well. As far as JFK went, it was even more, apparent when I saw what they had in there, that JFK had actually asked the CIA to look into what happened at Roswell with the UFOs landing and all those kinds of things. And so it was just interesting that each one of those three was interested in UFOs, and they put it in the CIA document. So that was quite fascinating to me. But it was the two lines of text right after that information in that CIA document, the first page, that opened up everything, because what it said is that the CIA was aware through wiretap conversations between Marilyn Monroe and Bobby Kennedy that Marilyn was going to the authorities, was going to the media about the love affairs with both Kennedys. She'd had enough of that. And the other one was the one that really made the difference, and that was that the CIA document said that Marilyn Monroe had threatened to go to the media about JFK's plan to have Fidel Castro assassinated.
Wow.
And if you can imagine, it's one thing for her to tell the media about the love affairs. That probably would have been passed over. But basically, they had leaked to her either through pillow talk or trying to impress her or whatever it was, Bobby or Jack, about matters of national security, which would be treason or whatever. So what happens then? Well, Bobby Kennedy obviously can't let her go to the media. And so what I found out is on the afternoon of August 4th, 1962, he and Peter Lawford went to her home. That's been confirmed. And basically begged her not to go to the media. And she told him, "I've had enough. I'm looking forward to being rid of you guys," and all of that kind of thing. And Marilyn Monroe then died that night. And in Collateral Damage, I give my version, my theory as to exactly how that happened, how Bobby orchestrated that through some operatives. I've been able to confirm since I published Collateral Damage two more accounts that basically confirm what I came up with. And so Marilyn Monroe is dead, and the medical examiner's office then, Dr. Noguchi, botched autopsy there, Frank, because he admitted later that he forgot to inspect a couple of Marilyn's organs, and by the time he figured that out, the organs were missing. But again, the headlines on Marilyn's case, Marilyn commits suicide, Marilyn kills herself, and all of that. And just like with Dorothy then, her reputation was ruined.
Sure.
And that has really concerned me. I get very passionate about the fact that both of these women were denied justice when they died.
So much of the Dorothy Kilgallen theory about the JFK assassination has to do with the role that the mob and different underworld figures played in the 1960 election, and then how the Kennedys, chiefly Robert Kennedy, the attorney general, sort of turned on the mob, who the Kennedys largely owed their election to in 1960. Why did the Kennedys do that? Why did they turn on their benefactors? Wouldn't the safer thing for them to be, not just physically, but in terms of their long-term political interest, wouldn't the safer thing for them to have done would have been to just carry on with some sort of benign neglect?
It's a three-letter word, ego. And, you know, Joe Kennedy wanted to be president of the United States. And yet, during World War II, when he was ambassador to Great Britain, he was nice to Adolf Hitler, pacified him, all that. When he came back to the U.S., then Joe's reputation was tarnished. Well, he said, look, I got all this money and power. If I can't be president, my boys will be president. It was going to be Joe Kennedy Jr., but he died in the war. Then it was going to be Jack for 8 years, Bobby for 8 years, and Ted for 8 years. And I'm not kidding. That has been confirmed for sure. So they get in the White House, and they're all in good shape, and the mafioso feel like that they can do whatever they want to because the White House is going to leave them alone. But Joe Kennedy, I think, wanted to show them that, hey, I'm still boss. We're in the White House. I have the President of the United States as my son. And by golly, I'm going to show you guys that, you know, this is who I am and everything. And then he chooses a guy. If there was anybody at the time with a bigger ego than Joe Kennedy, it was Bobby Kennedy. He'd always been the run of the litter. He was always trying to show his brother and his father that he was equal to them and everything. I think that's why he got involved with Marilyn Monroe. Joe Kennedy had his trophy wife. That was the actress Gloria Swanson. Here's Jack Kennedy with a beautiful Jackie Kennedy and running around with every woman that he can find. And now Bobby Kennedy, he's got Ethel with, I don't know, 10 kids at the time or whatever. But now he's got his trophy girlfriend, Marilyn Monroe. So it was all about ego, Frank. And basically then they went after the wrong guy. You can't mess around with those mafioso. I don't know if I told you my quick story about that, but I'd like to. It just shows what I have always had in the back of my mind. When I was with Good Morning America in the 70s, I was a roving reporter for them. Geraldo Rivera and I were the roving reporters, and they sent me to Philadelphia to interview a mafioso's lawyer. And we were shocked that he would talk to me, but he was going to. I went over there. I went to his office. We had a camera crew. And he told me a lot about the mafia's belief that they would get involved in the political scene in Atlantic City at that time. And it was just amazing. So they played that television interview the next morning. It was a big hit. And the producer called me in Philadelphia and said, Mark, don't leave. Go back and see if you can interview him again. So I got on the phone and I called that office, Frank, and a woman answered, and I said, is Mr. such and such there? And there was silence, and I said, excuse me, I said, is Mr. and I could tell she was upset, and I said, are you okay? And she said, well, Mr. Shaw, I guess you don't know. When my boss started his car this morning, it blew up.
Wow. Gee.
You can't mess around with those guys. They have their own rules.
So
and Bobby Kennedy broke those rules. Joe Kennedy broke those rules. And it's amazing to me that and then Bobby Kennedy getting involved with Marilyn Monroe and then being involved in her death. See, they think they can get away with those things. It's that they're bigger than life. They're above the law, whatever it may be. And I don't want to forget this conclusion that so many people have been shocked at with Collateral Damage, but it's absolutely true. And you have to kind of take it a little bit slow. But here's what happened because of Bobby Kennedy. If Bobby Kennedy had been prosecuted in 1962 for the death of Marilyn Monroe, based on all of the evidence that I've found and other credible reporters have, and journalists and authors have found, he would have had to have resigned as attorney general, which means he wouldn't have been had any power, which means that Marcello and his cohorts would not have had to have killed JFK to render Bobby powerless, because he would have been powerless after having to resign. And it stretches further, because there would have been no death of Marilyn Monroe, the murder of her in 65, because she would have not had a JFK assassination to investigate. So the three deaths are really collateral damage of Joe Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy's abuse of power in 1962. It's very logical. It's very common sense. And I'm kind of surprised at times with some of the reactions I get. Most of it is that I hate the Kennedys, which is not true. I appreciated many things that they did. And the other is that, you know, they just want to remember Camelot. They really don't want to think about that the Kennedys, were that bad. That was a very tragic time, if you think
sure.
about it, Frank, in the early 60s. Very tragic.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we certainly know in the mid to late 60s, we saw the assassination of civil rights leaders like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Those assassinations are still studied and reverberating to this day. But what you say is so interesting, that had they not turned on the mob and sort of broke this bargain that they had made with the devil, this deal with the devil, then the mob would have had no reason to emasculate Robert Kennedy by killing his brother. And then because that wouldn't have been happening, Dorothy Kilgallen wouldn't have been investigating that. She wouldn't have been killed. Marilyn Monroe would not have been killed. What was Dorothy Kilgallen's theory with respect to the John F. Kennedy assassination? Who did she believe were the key players in that assassination?
Well, I don't have too many regrets about what my research has shown. There's a couple that I could mention, but one of them is that, unfortunately, when Dorothy Kilgallen died and was murdered, her JFK assassination evidence file, her folder, was missing and is still missing. I've tried to find it in the New York Police Department. I've tried to find it in Cyrus Vance's office through Freedom of Information Acts. I haven't been able to find it. We should talk a little bit about President Biden not releasing JFK documents at some point. It may be in there.
What do you think is behind that? Why do you think President Biden still has an interest, as President Trump did before him, in terms of concealing those documents?
Let me just finish that that one thought, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because basically what Dorothy went with is that, she interviewed Jack Ruby. And so we don't know exactly what he told her. But where did she go again? She went to New Orleans. And she told her friends she was going to meet a source there who was going to give her all this evidence. I think there's no question she connected Marcello with Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald. I've been able, based on some of the new evidence that's in collateral damage, connected for sure Oswald and Marcello. And so I think she figured that out. And then, just as I did when I was addressing juries with regard to, representing clients, or I would do if I was trying to prosecute this particular case against Bobby and all of that, you look at motive. And who had the strongest motive to kill JFK? Well, probably people are thinking Lyndon Johnson. Why? Because you look at motive means opportunity and benefit from the crime. And who benefited more from JFK's death than anybody? Probably Lyndon Johnson, because he became president. But I've never been able to connect Lyndon Johnson to Jack Kennedy's death. It's just too difficult to do. And so you look at the next guy, and that's Marcello. He could not possibly let Bobby Kennedy deport him again. He was actually in court at the moment JFK died in New Orleans, charged with racketeering. He couldn't let Bobby convict him and send him to prison. And so Dorothy believed, and I think that's what she would have put in her book for Random House, that it was Carlos Marcello who orchestrated Bobby's death. And I will tell you that Bobby Kennedy, it's in Collateral Damage, told three or four people that he knew it was Carlos Marcello. He was no dummy. He knew that, you know, you can't go after those guys. So it was revenge on Carlos Marcello's part. And also the other person that knew about this, Joe Kennedy had a stroke, but he was still coherent and everything. And when Ted Kennedy walked in the bedroom where Joe was and told him JFK had been killed, he swept the New York Times off the bed and onto the floor. And basically, there's no question in my mind that he knew exactly what had happened, that his going after the media, trying to show them he was a big shot, had led to the death of his son.
We have to take one more break. We'll continue with Mark Shaw, author of the book Collateral Damage, in just a moment. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I love talking with Mark Shaw. He's one of my favorite people to talk to. You know who else I enjoy speaking with? Ronnie McMullen from GetTheTea.com. He's actually going to be here tomorrow. I'm going to talk to him about his great product, which I enjoy. It's called Life Change Tea. It detoxifies you. It cleanses you from the inside out, gives you a ton of energy. Without caffeine, it keeps you regular. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving Day, so I thought it would be appropriate to talk a little bit about how to keep the food moving. I mean, one of the great struggles many of us have is you overeat on Thanksgiving and then you feel like you just can't move. Well, GetTheTea.com keeps everything moving. If you haven't tried it yet, what are you waiting for? Go to GetTheTea.com and use the promo code Frank. It's all natural. It's no preservatives, no chemicals, non-GMO. And if you use the promo code Frank at GetTheTea.com, not only will you be able to get free shipping anywhere in these United States, but whatever you order on the site, and they have all sorts of great supplements, you can use the promo code Frank and enjoy free shipping. GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank. It is the tea that makes you go. I'm Frank Morano, taking a look at the deaths of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, and Dorothy Kilgallen, and where those intersect with one another. We'll continue with Mark Shaw in a moment.
WABC. The 77 WABC mobile app. Download it now. Talk Radio 77 WABC. Mark Levin. Entertaining and informative.
Kyle Rittenhouse should sue Joe Biden for millions because Joe Biden made it abundantly clear that he believed Kyle Rittenhouse was a white supremacist. When Joe Biden smeared Kyle Rittenhouse, he was a mere citizen like the rest of us. No protection.
The great one, Mark Levin. Weeknights at 6. Listen on the 77 WABC mobile app.
WABC.
Start your morning with Frank Morano on 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano, talking about the Kennedy assassination, as we've done a good portion of the week. And Mark Shaw has written 5 books about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But I have to tell you, I think his most recent is probably the most compelling, the most interesting, and the most groundbreaking. Mark Shaw is an attorney, an investigative journalist, and the author of the book Collateral Damage. Mark, we were talking a little bit about Joe Biden and his decision to keep many files related to the JFK assassination secret. Who is he protecting here? Why do you think the president is doing this?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send him a copy of Collateral Damage and have him read it, because it's a breakthrough book. Nobody's ever looked at the JFK assassination in context with the deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen. And when you do that, everything just opens up that way. And I'd love for him to read it, because he's getting some really bad advice. And I think maybe the other presidents did, too. We go back to the most recent former president wouldn't give us the JFK assassination documents. Obama wouldn't. Bush wouldn't. Clinton wouldn't. Nobody ever has. And basically what they used as excuses, Frank, you may know, was that there's matters of national security. Now, almost 60 years ago, what in the world can be in there? But that's what they used an excuse. But Biden came up with a brand new one. And I'd be interested in your opinion, because most people who read this said, wait a minute, what in the world is this about? Because he said he denied their release so as to protect against identifiable harm to the military defense intelligence operations, law enforcement, or the conduct of foreign relations. What in the world can be in there that is going to cause identifiable harm to the military defense, identifiable harm to intelligence operations, to law enforcement, or identifiable harm to the conduct of foreign relations? That's just a lame excuse, basically, not to give us those documents. Even the Kennedys have said, let's see them.
It makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. And I'm a little suspect of those documents, even when they're revealed. I have a strong feeling that they will echo exactly what the Warren Commission found in 1964, which, you know, to this day is one of the worst reports that was ever given about a major event like that. J. Edgar Hoover basically ramrodded all that about Oswald alone and everything. But I don't understand the president, these presidents just keeping them from things. This is why people don't believe in government.
Exactly.
No transparency whatsoever.
Oh, I can tell you, among New Yorkers, cynicism is pervasive, and that's bipartisan. There is universal distrust of the messaging that's coming out of the government. So just going back to the RFK death, you have a situation where the mob wants RFK to be powerless to prosecute them.
Mm-hmm.
Once he's out as Attorney General, largely he is. Is the reason that he was then assassinated in 1968 because there were people that were afraid he could actually win the presidency that year?
Oh, I think so. And this is something I'm continuing to research and trying to find because, again, if you go to motive, it's always concerned me about the whole Sirhan situation. That was all muddied in terms of a confession, and the jury heard that, and then they convicted him and all this. And so I've always wondered about all that. Of course, it's come back in the news because Robert Kennedy Jr. has jumped into that and you know, has tried to be a cheerleader for Sirhan being paroled and everything. But, you know, the motive is always what I look at. And Dorothy Kilgallen was great at looking at motive. She covered the Dr. Sam Shepard case that became the Fugitive movie, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case, all of the murder cases that she covered, she looked at motive just as I do. So who had the strongest motive, really, to kill Robert Kennedy? Well, it makes sense to me, at least, and I have not been able to make this connection yet, but I'm hoping to at some point. I believe it's Carlos Marcello. And here's the reason why. Bobby Kennedy was powerless in 1963, okay? But now Bobby Kennedy is going to, it looks like, and I think it probably would have happened, become president of the United States. Well, what's one of the first things he's going to do since he knows, as he told several of his associates, that it was Marcello that planned the assassination of his brother, the president? What's he going to do? He's going to come back after Marcello. And I believe that would have happened. And so Marcello can't let that happen.
Sure.
So just as I believe Oswald was certainly the patsy that he said he was with regard to JFK assassination, I think somehow or another Sirhan was the patsy there. But connecting that all up has been extremely difficult. So many people are still dead. I did find, I will tell you, and I haven't mentioned this on the air before, I did find that Sirhan at one point worked at Hollywood Racetrack, south of Los Angeles there. And one of the owners of that racetrack was Carlos Marcello.
Mm. Wow. That I had not heard. That is really wild. This is one of the reasons you've got to check out the book, Collateral Damage. So many of the sources, in fact, all the sources that Mark Shaw uses in this book are all primary sources. It's from the horse's mouth, eyewitnesses, text from the time, CIA documents, FBI documents. It's thoroughly researched, and it's something that is a fascinating read. How challenging is it, Mark, to do one book on three or four subjects? I imagine on one subject, it's tough enough, but to merge three in one, it's just forgetting about the substance of what the truth is. Just as in terms of crafting a narrative, I have to think that's pretty challenging.
Well, it's interesting, Frank. You know, I don't know how people feel about this, but I'll mention it. Dorothy Kilgallen, you know, from the hereafter, has kind of guided me along, I feel. I think she chose me to write her story and her book. And at times I felt like she was kind of guiding me in a certain direction or whatever. And when I was just about to quit and not write another book, I had the feeling that somewhere or another I ought to write about Marilyn. And so it was interesting because writing about one subject, as you say, and thank you for your kind comments. That means so much to me because I have such respect for you, Frank. But writing about three subjects was tremendously difficult, although I will tell you, once I got going, and in the book people will say the evidence is laid out like a prosecutor does, I basically had my research had been a little bit what you would call ass backwards, because normally what you would do is investigate Marilyn Monroe's death, 1962, JFK second, 63, Marilyn 65. But I had already investigated JFK's death first, then Dorothy Kilgallen's, and now Marilyn's. But doing so with JFK and Dorothy kind of opened a window for me when I started to get into Marilyn's death, because I saw these similarities and connections and all of that. So I started in, and I compare authors creatively to artists, because when the artist starts a painting, there's nothing on the canvas. And when an author starts a book, there's nothing on the page. And you start and you go and you do this and you do that and you do your research and then you put this together and everything. So finally, I got a draft of this book together, and I really alternate the life and times of each of these three subjects, and then at the end of the book with some conclusions, and also I humanize them at the end of the book, what each one of them lost because they died at an early age, and what we lost by them dying at an early age. And I think that's been important to people to realize what that's been all about. So I got this draft of the book. You'll get a kick out of this. I got this draft of the book, and I've used the same publisher for the last three books, and I sent it to him. And he said, all right, Mark, I think you've got something here. I'm going to have an editor look at it. So it was a couple weeks or 3 weeks, and finally I thought I would get back this editor's opinions, because editors are tough guys, and this guy was a very well-known one. And I thought he would write back and say, Mark, well, you need to move this and that, and this doesn't make sense or anything like that. And lo and behold, he wrote back and he said, I think you've got it. So I was as surprised as I possibly could, but it all just kind of came together. And I'm so pleased it did, because this is my contribution to history. I think I told you maybe the last time that my body of work is being archived by my alma mater, Purdue University. The other thing I should mention, in case you don't know it, is quite an honor, and I think this will help me with regard to my investigations of Dorothy's death and Marilyn's death through the L.A. County District Attorney, who's refused to answer my letters about reinvestigating Marilyn's death. About a month ago, it was announced in the Hollywood trades that
I was just going to ask you about this. This is very exciting.
The actor-producer Mark Wahlberg's production company in Hollywood optioned the media rights of Collateral Damage for a documentary feature film. And that means a lot to me, because I think they're going to try to do that kind of through Dorothy's eyes, and we'll be able to show these connections between the three and what happened to them and everything. So I'm really honored that they decided to do
Absolutely.
This, and they've promised me they'll stay close to the truth of the book, so
well,
that means a lot.
Congratulations on that. That's Thank very you. Exciting. I can't wait to see the documentary. There's a ton of other questions that I have about this book and about this investigation. I'm sure our listeners do as well. Many of them will be answered if they get the book, Collateral Damage by Mark Shaw. Mark, promise me you'll come back soon. It's always such a fascinating conversation.
Oh, thanks so much, Frank. And people, get in touch to me. Go to markshawbooks.com. Send me emails. I answer every single one of them. But thank you so much.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Until next hour.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Catchy song. I just want to let that song play. Who wants to hear me? Good morrow, everybody. This is The Other Side of Midnight, the Thanksgiving Eve edition
of The Other Side of Midnight. I love Thanksgiving Eve. Thanksgiving Eve has meant different things to me at different points in my life. You know, when you are in high school and college, Thanksgiving Eve is one of the big party nights that there are. Right. Because especially if you're a senior or if you're a senior and you were friends with people that are a year or two older than you, Thanksgiving Eve is when all your friends who went away to college came back home. So it was a night to go out with all your friends. Same thing. Now, I never went away to college, but all of my friends that did go away to college, they would all come back. So it was always a big party night. Then for those of us that are pro wrestling fans, Matt Blaze, I think maybe you'll appreciate this, Thanksgiving Eve was always the night of what?
Thanksgiving Eve was Survivor Series.
Survivor Series. That's right. It started out on Thanksgiving, but then they ended up moving it to Thanksgiving Eve, which I think was a much better day for it. I think Survivor Series actually already took place on Sunday. I miss when they had it on Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving Eve. That they don't really even do, I don't think, a conventional Survivor Series anymore where you have teams of wrestlers wrestling with one another. It was really one of the most interesting pay-per-views, but I digress. Those of you that wanted to comment on JFK and Dorothy Kilgallen, I'm going to get to you in a mere moment. But I am going to be here tomorrow. We'll be here tomorrow. I'm going to be off Friday morning. So this is usually a subject that I would say, you know what? I'm going to give you a day to think about this. I was going to delve into this now, but I'm going to give you a day to think about this because there's a lot of people that want to comment on everything that we've done over the course of the last hour. So I'm going to get to those folks. But here, take the next 23 hours and do the following. I just made my list. This is an annual tradition, and we're going to continue this tomorrow. There's a lot of great Christmas films. There are not a large number of Thanksgiving films. Now, a lot of families are going to get together, and they're looking for something to do in between courses, in between the lasagna and the antipasto, in between the manigot and the turkey, in between the course 3 and 400. Maybe they want to watch a film. And Thanksgiving, even though you don't have to be Christian to celebrate Thanksgiving, Thanksgiving does not have as many great films as Christmas does. So what we're going to do tomorrow, together, you and me, we are going to compile a Thanksgiving movie guide. If someone's looking for something great to watch on Thanksgiving, what would you suggest? Don't answer me now. Answer me tomorrow. And Matt, come armed with your answer tomorrow, too. And Philip is here as well. We'll get Philip's answer. We'll all make our list. I made my list. We'll give you a day to make your list. In the meantime, 800-848-9222. If you want to comment on anything we've covered thus far. But let me take a moment to take you back in time to just about, I don't know, maybe about 3 weeks ago. It was right after the mayoral election. I think it was November 12th or so, right around there. It was November 9th. So what was that? It was 17 days. I'm not great with math. No, that was 15 days ago, right? November 9th. Okay. November 9th. Let us go back in time. I was trying to figure out, and I was sort of wondering out loud why New York City's new mayor, Eric Adams, has become so obsessed with cryptocurrency. And I was sort of thinking out loud. And, well, listen to this. This is November 9th, 2021. The thing that I did wonder, what I did scratch my head about, is one of the leading cryptocurrency advocates in the whole country
is a guy named Brock Pierce. He had been a star of Juliet's Clapping. Hello, Juliet. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You look busy. I won't bother you.
Okay.
But Brock Pierce had a small role in the Mighty Ducks films. He was in a movie with Sinbad as a child. He was a child actor, and then he became a cryptocurrency billionaire. Now, Brock is one of the leading cryptocurrency promoters in the country. If you might have heard him. He's been on this show. He's been on the Cats Roundtable and or the Cats at Night show. And the thing that's interesting about Brock, and I found this curious, almost Brock Pierce ran for president last year as a third party candidate. He was not on the ballot in enough states to win, but he was on the ballot in New York. And he did an interview on the Bernie and Sid show, did an interesting interview. I had him on my Long Island show at the time and on this show. He did an interview with Curtis and Juliet. I thought he came across very well in all three of those forums. But Curtis was really the only major media figure or political figure in the whole country to endorse Brock Pierce for president. Curtis endorsed Brock Pierce. Now, that was sort of a risky thing for Curtis to do, knowing that he was going to run for mayor a few months later as a Republican, and then here he is endorsing an independent. And yet, this is what I found so curious. The day after Eric Adams was certified as the winner of the primary, Brock Pierce puts on Facebook a whole big message of congratulations to Eric Adams, the next mayor of New York City. You know, he's going to do a great job. And I thought to myself, huh, that's interesting. Curtis endorsed this guy, and now he doesn't even pretend that he's neutral in this race. He could have said, well, you know, the New Yorkers have two great candidates to choose from, Eric Adams and Curtis Sliwa, or whoever wins, the people are well served, or, you know, congratulations to Eric Adams, who's very likely to be the next mayor of New York City. He didn't have to mention Curtis, but you would have thought he would give Curtis a little bit of respect, given the fact that Curtis was the only person who endorsed him. So I pretty much saw that and forgot about it the next day because, you know, it didn't matter too much. But the fact that Brock is so pro-crypto and that now Adams, once he's elected, has become so pro-crypto leads me to think that maybe there's some sort of connection there. Maybe the reason Brock was so gung-ho on Eric Adams is because Brock and Eric Adams had some sort of an understanding that Adams would embrace cryptocurrency for New York City. Now, that was November 9th. My contention, as you heard laid out there, we're back in the present day now, by the way. As you heard there, my contention was that somehow Brock Pierce, who, again, was endorsed by Curtis. Curtis did not endorse the Republican, Donald Trump. Eric Adams did not endorse Brock Pierce. Curtis endorsed Brock Pierce. And then Brock Pierce comes out and does nothing for Curtis. I don't think he even gave him a contribution. And he comes out and does this whole big thing in basically endorsing Eric Adams. My contention was, the reason Eric Adams went from not talking about crypto during the campaign to talking about it all the time now was because Brock Pierce had persuaded him somehow or another. Now, the day after Election Day, Eric Adams went to Puerto Rico for the SOMOS conference. We covered it at the time. Now, Eric Adams said at the time that he paid his own way there, that there was no government money, no campaign money. He said he paid his own way. Well, it turns out that was not entirely true. Who paid for Eric Adams to go to Puerto Rico? Well, more appropriately, who took Eric Adams to Puerto Rico? Yes, you guessed it. Brock Pierce. Brock Pierce. See, this is why you have to listen to this show. I told you this was coming. So Eric Adams partied with Brock Pierce on Election Day. On election night, after winning in a landslide, Adams went with cryptocurrency billionaire Brock Pierce to this swanky lower Manhattan club called Zero Bond. 2 days later, he tweeted that he would take his first three paychecks in Bitcoin when he becomes mayor. And later that day, he caught a ride to the island destination on Pierce's private jet. Now, for starters, number one, I don't think that's exactly paying your own way.
riding on a crypto billionaire's private jet is not exactly paying your own way to Puerto Rico. If it is, Eric Adams and I have two different definitions of paying your own way to Puerto Rico. Number two, this is exactly what happened. I don't know what Brock Pierce said to Eric Adams, but somehow between the election and today, Brock Pierce convinced Eric Adams to become a big believer in crypto. And there's a reason that Brock Pierce did not back the only major political figure in the country to support him and instead backed Eric Adams. And now I think maybe you're seeing this in Eric Adams' embrace of crypto. And again, I'm not saying anything surreptitious was done here, although, look, this does look a little fishy. Saying you're paying your own way and then riding on a billionaire's private jet, it does look a little fishy. You got to admit it. But Brock Pierce owns millions, probably hundreds of million dollars worth of cryptocurrency. Eric Adams declaring that New York is going to be the cryptocurrency capital of the world, what is that going to do? It's going to cause the price of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general to go up. Who benefits? The people that own cryptocurrency. Who owns cryptocurrency? Brock Pierce. So do you see what's gone on here? And again, I like a lot of what Eric Adams has been saying, but we have a mayoral candidate. Well, we have a mayor-elect who, let's be honest here, let's be frank, because I happen to be frank all the time. We have a mayor-elect who lied about paying his own way to Puerto Rico. He did not pay his own way to Puerto Rico. He didn't. Number two, we have a mayor who is embracing cryptocurrency in a big way. He will embrace cryptocurrency more than any mayor in the country, including the mayor of Miami, and more than any mayor of New York City we've ever had. That will lead to crypto going up and people that own Bitcoin benefiting financially. So Brock Pierce benefits financially from Eric Adams' embrace of crypto. Doesn't that look a little fishy that Brock Pierce is also lending him this private jet? You know, I try to view these situations objectively, and I'm working on a column today about who I'd like to see in the new Eric Adams administration that should be published in the next day or two. But I got to say, that looks a little fishy. Brock Pierce benefits financially. Eric Adams gets a free trip to Puerto Rico and he gets to hobnob with the bigwigs over at Zero Bond. And it's very interesting. Not a subject we heard anything from Eric Adams in the campaign about. I find it quite suspicious, quite honestly. 800-848-9222. You can weigh in as you see fit. Hey, we're going to talk with Ralph Romeo in just a few minutes. You might not know the name Ralph Romeo, but I'm betting you know the voice if you're a veteran talk radio listener. Ralph Romeo is a fella that has been calling talk radio for years. He calls us Ralph from Manhattan. He's also an actor. He also does a radio talk show or has been a radio talk show host. And we're going to pick his brain on a number of issues as well. But he's a bright guy and a guy that just sounds good. So we're going to talk with him about a wide variety of subjects. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Van in Rockland County. Hello, Van.
Hi.
Hi.
I had some comments about the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
First of all, nobody in the world ever noticed it because they don't know how to look at photographs. But in the Mormon photo, the face of the killer is there. And he has prominent cheekbones. He's bald. His eyes are fixed in a stare. And what looks like a mustache is a word, Sobibor, a German death camp. And at first, I didn't know who he was. It took me a few years to figure it out. And he was a mind-controlled robot. Some of the mind-controlled techniques were done in Russia, and then the CIA was involved with it. And he did a number of other things, and he had no interest in JFK. He was a weaponized human being, and the best description of that technique was in the movie, The Manchurian
Candidate. Yeah, I did a whole thing on the MK Ultra program the other day where we went into some of those techniques. Was that a play here? I don't know. But that is not covered in Mark Shaw's book, Collateral Damage. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Diana in Manhattan. Hello, Diana.
Hi, it's Diana Montford. I met Dorothy Kilgallen. My mother, when I was really small, my mother, Carmen Campbell, was under contract to 20th Century Fox Movie Tone here in New York. And she was a member of the Overseas Press Club. And one night we're there, my mother, my grandmother, and I, and there's Dorothy Kilgallen. And as you know, Dorothy Kilgallen was on, I was going to say
this. What's
right,
my line?
Right.
Sure.
Right, that's it. And I was thrilled. Oh, look, look, look. So my mother, who knew her, took me over to her and introduced me. And it was very nice, and Dorothy was very nice. I mean, you know, I was a 5 or 6 year old kid. She's not going to hit me or anything, right? And it was delightful, and she was a lovely lady. Very pretty. I've read since then, oh, boy, what an ugly chick. Oh, ugly, ugly. You know, Frank Sinatra, whom I love, was always saying, oh, boy, what a dog. She wasn't. She was quite pretty. And it was very nice. And
all right. Any thoughts about this murder?
I'm sorry?
Any thoughts about anything we discussed for the last hour, the murders or anything?
Yes, everybody, when Dorothy Kilgallen died, I was 9 years old in 1965. And even as a 9-year-old, I remember everyone was saying, oh, yeah, she was murdered because of what she knew about the Kennedy assassination. And that was in all the papers at the time. Everyone strongly suspected that she was murdered because, of course, she told everyone, well, you know, I'm going to crack the case. And maybe you shouldn't say that if you're going to crack the case. And, yeah, everyone knew.
All right, well, then let's hope.
People in the street knew it.
Let's hope the NYPD reopens this investigation, because I think the evidence is pretty compelling that she was murdered. 800-848-WABC. Richard is in Parsippany. Hello, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Yeah, let me just say, look, Mark Shore is complete fraud. All this stuff was covered in a book called Case Closed. And any slick back mobster that we verified in the Kennedy would be Jack Ruby. Now, the biggest mission of John Kennedy was to stop weapons proliferation. And at that time, Jews and this Israel wanted to get weapons. Jack Kennedy was not going to let them get weapons. That's why he's dead. Now, if we're talking about who killed John Kennedy, has been killing people up to today, well, the expert on that and the person that who has solved that mystery is Donald Trump, and his statement that they're caught. He has caught them. It's the CIA, FBI. They are the murderers of all these people from then to now. Now John Kennedy was murdered right under the nose of the Secret Service. Oswald was murdered right under the nose of the Dallas police. Mm-hmm. So, you know, connect the dots. Dorothy Kilgallen was killed because she interviewed Jack Ruby, the only verifiable gangster associated with all these goings on. That's why she was guilty. She got hard evidence from Jack Ruby.
Well, so I'm not sure, Richard, why, you know, where Israel and the Jews come in. Where do they come in with respect to
Kennedy? Come on. Jews are, you know, Jews are the same as gypsies. They are people.
There you go. I don't know that you need much of a response from me about that, but Richard's anti-Semitism is so poisonous that he doesn't have evidence like Mark Shaw does. He just has a virulent hatred towards Jews, and he's prepared to blame them for everything, including killing John F. Kennedy. There you have it. 800-848-WABC. John is in Bergen County. Hello, John.
Hello, Frank. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh,
you guys have
put together some lineup at ABC. It's like the Murderer's Row of radio. I just wanted to comment quickly on the edge on the declining willingness of kids to have babies today. I think a lot of it goes back to the educational system. They're teaching a whole different set of values in education today than they were 20 years ago, and even more so than they were 50 years ago. And it's obviously moved to the left. And at the same time, there's an attack on religion, which is basically the foundations of families and having children. So I think if you take those two together, it's pretty much the cause. We've heard the effects, you know, the laziness and all that, but that's all being taught in school. The lack of self-reliance, all these things are being taught as a leftist agenda. And it's just come to the forefront now with this critical race theory. They've actually pushed it too far. If they just kept doing what they were doing, they would have been just fine. But they went so far that there's this huge backlash. So I think that's pretty obvious. But
well, John, you may be right. You may be right. Thank you very, very much. 800-848-WABC. Carol is in New Jersey. Hello, Carol.
Hi there, Frank. You know, I'm wondering if Mark Shaw ever interviewed Rosie Grier, the football player, because the night that Robert Kennedy was shot, he was acting as a bodyguard for him. And he saw Sirhan shoot him, and he tackled him until the police arrived. And he's still around. He's still definitely with us. But I'm wondering if he ever spoke with him.
Well, you know, it's funny. Maybe we should try and get Rosie Grier on the show to talk about that. And obviously, he's got a lot of insight into the OJ situation as well. So that might certainly be interesting. 800-848-9222. Pete is on Staten Island. Hello, Pete.
Hey, Frank, what a riveting show. I am glued to the Lexus. I mean, the whole time since 1 o'clock.
Wonderful. Good. That's what we like to hear.
I had a top. Well, the topic I was going to talk about interfaith marriage, because me and Renee are, but I want to jump over to Thanksgiving, because that's what's coming up now. We could always do that another show, because I don't want to take up too much time. But about Thanksgiving, I'm going to my daughter's. We have everything catered from Canlan's and two other places, because we're going to have a feast. But it's going to be a lot of football games lined up. So what we did was we put another TV set in my daughter's living room, and I am going to be glued to the TV set with a Bose headphone, and I'm going to be wearing a shirt. If you don't want to talk about football, let's not talk about anything else, you know, because I'm going to have six people there that I never met in my life. My daughter, because I'm not vaxxed and Renee ain't vaxxed, because we have the antibodies and the T cells at 79, and our doctor advised us it's got to go down to 31 or we're going to get sick with an overdose. Well, that's why a lot of these people have reactions, because they have the T cells and the antibodies and they take the shot, and that's why they get sick. But anyway, getting away from that, because that's debatable with everybody. But my daughter has testing. She has regular nose testing, and she has that sputum testing that you spit in the thing. But that test takes about 3 hours. And the other test takes an hour, because she has it through her job, because she works for ACS, Children's Services. She's somebody that you never want visiting your home, you know, because of the situation, and she does a great job. So that's the whole thing. We're gonna, anybody that wants to get the spit test has to get to the house for breakfast, and then whoever wants to take the thing with the up the nose thing got to get there an hour before, because she's testing everybody that's coming.
Yeah, well, I hope you have a great Thanksgiving, Pete, and thank you for your nice compliments about the show. I'm taking the Raiders on Thursday. I don't know who you're taking, but
I'm in that corner. Matter of fact, I got a way I'm not losing money. Guys that I know are big bettors, and they're throwing in bets for me. So I'm going to lose. I don't lose any money.
There you go. There you go, Pete. That's the spirit. All right, we're going to talk with Ralph Romeo in just a minute, but first, we're going to give you an opportunity to win $1,000 if you are the seventh caller to 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. We're going to give you an opportunity to answer 10 questions in 60 seconds. That's 800-848-9222. In the meantime, my mother is preparing, I think there are five of us for Thanksgiving. She's preparing a feast for 30, maybe more. Maybe we'll be more than five if Sharon in Manhattan comes, because she strikes me as a delightful Thanksgiving companion. But the bottom line is, Thanksgiving is a holiday where we tend to overeat. You've heard me talk about Mitch Suss and his medical weight loss center in Westchester, the Skinny Center. And after researching a lot of these other weight loss programs and seeing how my colleague Greg Kelly has lost all that weight, I decided this program is worth a try. I can't wait to go through their exclusive lab testing that tells you why you can't stop eating. And I'm going to start this right after the holidays. But until then, Mitch has sent me a product that will help control my appetite and stop me from overindulging for the holidays. It's called Skinny Spritz. I'm amazed by this product. A few spritzes and your appetite is gone, suppressed. Mitch told me that patients use Skinny Spritz to help adhere to the program. The hardest part can be getting started, and this product gives you a jump start. So call the Skinny Center at 914-703-4811 or go to theskinnycenter.com. That's theskinnycenter.com. 914-703-4811. The $1,000 Minute and Ralph Romeo next.
Start your morning with Frank Morano on 77 WABC.
Rolling Stones here on the other side of midnight. This is Frank Morano. We'll talk with Ralph Romeo momentarily, but let's give one lucky listener an opportunity to win some money.
The Other Side of Midnight presents...
It's the $1,000 Minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Chris Libertini. Let us say hello to today's contestant, Lenny in Fort Lauderdale. Hello, Lenny.
Hey, what do you say, Frank? How are you?
I'm well. Happy holidays to you. And
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to us down there in Florida. How's the weather down there?
That's pretty nice.
All right. Good. So now, Lenny, you're familiar with the contest, right?
I heard it once or twice, so I figured I'd take a shot, but
okay, good.
I think you're going to stump me.
No. You got to have confidence. Those are the two things. You got to remain calm. That's the most important thing I've learned, because the questions themselves are not difficult. People just get tripped up when they get nervous. So just remain calm. So the way that's going to go
I'm hoping for a lot of sports questions.
Okay. Well, let's see. Are there any sports questions? There's at least one. So, the way this is going to go is, after I ask the first question, we're going to start a timer for 60 seconds. If you get a question right, we're just going to move on to the next question so that we can roll through these in as little time as possible. Okay? Ready to go?
I guess so.
All right. What month is it?
This is November.
What planet is also known as the Red Planet?
Mars.
How many members of the U.S. Supreme Court are there?
Seven.
Unfortunately not, Lenny. Unfortunately, there are nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court. You have Chief Justice Roberts. You have Justice Kennedy. Not Kennedy anymore. You have Justice Roberts.
I never got to the sports.
Next time, Lenny. Thank you. Grab Lenny's information. We'll give him a hat. But you have Sotomayor. You have, obviously, Kagan. You have Clarence Thomas. You have... Sam Alito, Neil Gorsuch, obviously Kavanaugh. You have Amy Coney Barrett. You have, did I name everybody? Is that nine? I think that's nine. There are nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court. They could change that anytime, but there are indeed nine members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Breyer. I didn't mention Breyer. Breyer and I think that's everybody. Yeah, Breyer. All right. Hey, without further ado, I want to welcome a regular caller to Talk Radio, somebody that's also been as Ralph from Manhattan, but he's also a pretty distinguished radio talk show host in his own right, a few spots down the dial. He's an actor. He does a whole bunch of other things. I asked him to send me a bio, but he didn't. So we'll refer to him as an actor and somebody that does a whole bunch of other things. The one and only Ralph Romeo. Ralph, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Oh, Frank, thank you so much at this ungodly hour, but let's do it for good. I mean, I was listening to your program. Fantastic. I don't get to listen too often because I am catching my Z's, but man, you know, the caliber of callers are fantastic.
Well, you know, it's funny. I haven't heard from you as much on the radio as I used to. What have you been so busy doing?
Well, I've been calling. You know, I have, you know, you get obsessed with this and yeah. You feel as though you have to make that call when something strikes you. And I give my friends a call on the radio all the time, just not 3 o'clock in the morning, not lately.
Now, Ralph, what do you, I know you've done some acting and you've done some other things in terms of fitness and you've done some other things in terms of radio, but what do you do on a day-to-day basis? What does most of your day consist of?
On a day-to-day basis, well, I'll tell you, my mother, who is 86 years old, she fell ill a couple of years ago. And, you know, she's a wonderful woman. And I've been consumed since this insidious virus began of taking care of her. Now we have her situated somewhere. Now I'm back to concentrating on what I do. I mean, I do my radio talk show. I have two programs down the dial. I really don't want to. I can give you details on it in a bit. But, you know, more or less, I'm concentrating on that. I still train people. I'm a personal trainer on the side. But, you know, everything's a little bit slower these days and everything's so, so different. People are still hesitating and going back to work. And, you know, things have changed substantially, and we have to adopt, I guess. Adapt.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get in touch with you to try to retain your services as a personal trainer, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you know, I have, you know, you can reach me at RomeoRalph890 at Gmail. That's my email. That's the best way to reach
me. RomeoRalph890.
But I'm telling you right now, I'm just concentrating on my radio shows, and that's really what I'm doing.
Well, that's great, and we wish the best of luck to your mom as well. What are you guys doing for Thanksgiving?
Well, you know, small little dinner here, not really doing too much, and you know, we're just trying to get focused and do our thing. And actually, when we you know, eat our Thanksgiving dinner. We you know, it's the kind of, we get together with a couple of friends, make it a small gathering, and just go from there.
Well, that's terrific. Now, today or tomorrow, they are bringing back the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in all its glory. Last year, it was a parade without people because of the virus. Are you a Thanksgiving Day Parade guy, Ralph? Do you go to the parade? What's your take on the parade?
I have to tell you about the parade. I don't care for parades, but this is New York all the way. I mean, you have something that people gather. It's a wonderful morning. You know, if I ever had the chance these days to make it over there, I would. But right now, I'm not going to be able to get there on Thursday. But that's a fantastic venue to go and just enjoy yourself. But this thing that they had to discontinue because of such trouble last year, the fact that we have it going again is great for New York. It's just a wonderful thing. But parades, actually, Frank, are not my thing. I'm not really a parade kind of a guy.
Well, hey, different strokes for different folks, that's for sure. Now, I know you've done some acting. Kevin Spacey is very much in the news. Have you ever worked with him at all? Have you ever been in any production with Kevin Spacey? He's been quite prolific.
I met him a couple of times. A very nice man. And let me tell you something, as far as any kind of talent goes, Kevin Spacey was among the greatest that we had.
Oh,
and
yeah.
when this thing went down, you know, I was disturbed as anybody, but now, you know, he's being, I think he has to come up with $31 million, if I'm not mistaken. That's a serious sum for anybody. But, you know, if he's a serial harasser, I mean, he deserves what he gets, but you know, it's difficult when an allegation comes out, Frank, and, you know, there's no substantial evidence against the accused and the name is out there. And maybe some of the things are indeed true, some not so much. That once that name is out there, Frank, you have you know, you just really ruin somebody's reputation.
Well, that's true.
When you say Kevin Spacey now, Frank, what do you think of?
Yeah.
Do you think of great actor? Or do you think of a serial harasser?
Yeah, no,
which do you think of?
No, certainly it's the latter. And if people aren't up on this story, an arbitrator has indeed ordered Kevin Spacey to pay almost $31 million to Media Rights Capital, which is the production company behind House of Cards, the Netflix series in which the actor starred for 5 seasons until he was fired in 2017. So this revelation came in a petition filed Monday in Los Angeles in the Superior Court there, in which they're asking the court to confirm the award in its favor and enter a judgment against Spacey. And I got to say, you know, look, this strikes me as a little unfair, and I'm not anybody that's going to defend a sexual assaulter or a sexual harasser. And look, if he was carrying on in this kind of conduct, he certainly should have been fired. And if he was doing anything criminal, he should certainly be prosecuted. But it seems a little unjust, as much as I'm a victim's rights advocate, it seems a little unjust to charge someone $31 million for the privilege of being fired.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. When that, again, what is true, what is fiction, you know, and how much can you believe? Because actually, it's a piling on situation many times. The person becomes very vulnerable, and then everyone out of the woodwork comes forward, and they seem to have an accusation of their own. And you have to wonder, you know, where does it end? I mean, is everyone going to be canceled? But some people deserve to be canceled, but some not so much. And I think it's a, you know, wide swath that sometimes everyone begins to go down in flames, and I don't think that's fair.
Now, let me ask you about the situation involving Dave Chappelle. Dave Chappelle had he's a comedian, obviously. He had a very controversial Netflix special in which he makes some jokes about trans people, makes some racial humor, and there were a lot of calls to cancel Dave Chappelle and take this special off of Netflix. The CEO of Netflix decided not to do that. Now, a software engineer and her former colleague are, you know, a Netflix employee is resigning in protest. This is a trans Netflix employee who has quit Netflix over this. Give me your thoughts on the whole Chappelle situation and desire of this one employee to quit.
Hey, a comedian can't be a comedian anymore, right? I mean, just the very definition. You have to tackle some pretty delicate subjects, and you have to do it in a manner in which is not necessarily very genteel. You got to go about your business and make people laugh. That's their goal when they walk up there. You know, Dave Chappelle, again, not exactly my cup of tea. You know, I giggle at what he says. I get into what he says from time to time. But, you know, you go up there, you push the envelope. You know, if you're up there playing it safe, you'd never have a Lenny Bruce. You'd never have a Richard Pryor. You'd have guys just kind of walking on the eggshells up there. Now, I think the woman's name is Tara Field, I believe.
That's right.
If she stands by her convictions and she wanted, you know, and she feels as though she can't work for a company in which, you know, that magnifies Chappelle and puts him out there to be seen, and that goes against what she believes. You know, I admire somebody for standing for their principles. But as far as Chappelle goes, I can, you know, I listen to him. This is the material he's been doing
forever, for
the last 15 years. Yeah. This is nothing new. It's just that we have changed.
Well,
and Chappelle. Yeah.
That's, and with people just tuning in, we're talking with Ralph Romeo, and he is somebody that's been involved in radio, physical fitness, and acting for a long time. Do you think that will ever change? Is there going to be sort of a backlash to the, for lack of a better description, the wokeness that's paralyzing comedy and motion pictures and many other aspects of media? Or is it only going to get worse? What's your prediction?
There better be. Without that backlash, you have no. The arts will suffer. If you watch a play, if you go and you want to see a good drama, and you see something controversial on stage, or you go to see your favorite movie, it's supposed to make you think. It's supposed to make you reflect. It's not. It's supposed to actually be something to talk about, Frank, on the way home. You know, if you, that's when the actors have done their job. When you go home and you discuss what you just saw on stage or on film, that's the crux of the whole thing. That's what makes it something to enjoy. If everyone was just, if the writers were very aware of so many different people that they can, whose toes they can step on, they wouldn't be able to write freely and you wouldn't get anything worthwhile to go and see. So
right.
That backlash that you hear, Frank, or that you hear all over the place, that's real. And that's from guys like me wanting to see some cutting edge material. And in 2021, it's virtually impossible.
Ridley Scott, he is a famous film director. He's directed all sorts of great films over the last few decades. And he did a film called The Last Duel, starring Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. It opened last month in theaters to less than stellar ticket sales. And now Ridley Scott is giving his take on why that's the case. He says that he was on Mark Maron's podcast. I'm sorry I didn't have a chance to pull the audio, but he said that Disney did a fantastic promotional job. And he said, according to him, there may be a particular generation who might be to blame for the absence in sales. This is what he said. Quote.
Hey,
go ahead.
Frank, he's right.
Well, this is what he said. Let me tell you what he said. Let me tell you what he said before I get your comment. He said, I think what it boils down to, what we've got today are these audiences who are brought up on these effing cell phones. The millennium do not ever want to be taught anything unless you're told it on a cell phone. Give me your take on that, Ralph.
It's a little strong. You know, you're painting with that broad brush. And, you know, I know a lot of young people, should I say, that, you know, do very well and without that phone. But I'll tell you, how many people, Frank, do you see with that head crooked, looking down? They spend their entire day looking at that phone, detached from reality, so to speak. You see it all the time. Ridley Scott has a point, but maybe, just maybe, he should try playing a little bit more toward these people. That may be a demographic he would want to, you know, get on his side. And, you know, you tend to alienate people, again, when you say the whole cast of millennials can't comprehend what I'm saying. They're too involved with the phone. But Frank, tell me something. When you see everybody on their phone, you see a line leading, you know, New York, everybody stands online. You see a line, everybody down with the phone. No one's speaking to each other. Everyone with the
That's
phone,
true.
The phone,
That's
the
true.
Phone from morning till night. This is not healthy. This
That's
is
true.
And you know, I'm guilty sometimes. That's the
oh,
thing.
Me
you
too.
Can fall into this trap all the time.
Me too.
And this is the, yeah, this is not healthy, but this is where I think there may be a turnaround in this. There may be people that put away their phones. When I go on the subway, which was last night, it was a little dangerous, but I sat there anyway. I see people actually, I saw a couple of people actually reading a book. Now that's a concept you don't see very often, but I actually see some people going against, norms and actually going back to actually reading a book and maybe talking to people. That would be something just to have a conversation these days.
Right. I've heard about books. I think I saw one in a museum one time. Very quickly, Ralph, J.K. Rowling, the writer of the Harry Potter series, she is slamming some of these trans activists who shared her address on social media. And she is calling this troubling, and she's saying that this is very inappropriate. And she said that this is going to do nothing to keep her from speaking up for women's sex-based rights. Give me your take on the trans activists versus J.K. Rowling.
Well, Rowling, she made a very definitive statement, one that I don't see as controversial. And here's a woman who's been a proponent of transgender rights throughout her career. I've seen her. I've never seen a transphobic remark that I can remember. They actually gave, I think you just said it, they gave her address and they went in front of her home and protested. And that's frightening. Think about it. You're in your own home. You have a group outside who's not very friendly. And they're outside screaming a lot of obscenities and different things at you. That's frightening. The home address, the lack of privacy, the way people just throw it around willy-nilly and they can invade on one's privacy so easily. That this has to stop because, number one, dangerous. Number one, and number two, wrong. This is something that if I disagreed, you know, wholeheartedly with someone, I can kind of get my thoughts out mm-hmm. without threats, without actually going to their home, invading them the way these people obviously did. I'm on Rowling's side on this one.
All right, Ralph, we're going to have to end it there. We're going to have you back on the show soon. Maybe we'll get you in studio next time in spite of the early hour.
Yeah, no, I would really appreciate it. By the way, Craig, if I may, it's all, you know, my program that I do at night is 8 p.m. Eastern time. And, you know, it's the one thing about social media and things, I can get the word out cross country and people actually listen to my little radio station up the dial WPAT. And, you know, I do this thing and many people can hear me that ordinarily wouldn't hear me. And it's a wonderful thing. So it's not all bad.
Yeah.
My show starts 8 o'clock on weeknights up at that station.
Thank you. And people could search Ralph Romeo on Facebook if they want to know more about what he's up to. And we're going to do 15 seconds of fame next. 800-848-9222. We have 1, 2, 3 open lines. If you want to jump on board, that's 800-848-WABC. In the meantime, I want to talk to you a little bit about how you can whip inflation now. Remember the old win buttons? Gerald Ford used to have whip inflation now. How do you do it? You do it with gold. You do it with silver. You do it with precious metals. Larry Kudlow's been talking to you about this. Rudy Giuliani's been talking to you about this. A lot of people more intelligent than I am have told you that gold and precious metals offer a hedge against inflation and protect you in your retirement. So if you have an existing retirement account, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA, and you really should do it with legacy precious metals. When the stock market collapsed back in 2008, people that were invested in gold saw huge gains while everybody else suffered. Well, that may happen again. And that's why gold should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio. Legacy is the company you can trust because they give you unbiased counsel based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit legacypminvestments.com. It is the other side of midnight. I am Frank Morano, taking you straight until 5 a.m. You'll get to hear the WABC early news. But we will end this Thanksgiving Eve edition of the show. Again, I'll be back tomorrow. Curtis is going to be here on Friday from 1 to 5, I believe. I think he's doing the morning show that day, too. So it's going to be a long morning for Curtis. But we will be back tomorrow regardless. And I'll tell you what the plan is for Friday. We're going to end this show as we do each and every day with
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
15 seconds. Any comment is fair game. 800-848-WABC. Tom's in the Bronx. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to say that if Bezos, that millionaire, multimillionaire, wants to do something good, he would have put his money into needed projects people need instead of putting it into hideous projects that cause mayhem.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. Fred in Yonkers.
Hey, at this time of year, I'm thankful for the Frank Morano Show and The Other Side of Midnight. That song sticks in my head like a dolly japa. We want the Flory Dories. We want the Flory Dories.
800-848-9222. Neil on Staten Island.
On Thanksgiving, let's take a moment to pray for the Americans stranded in Afghanistan and also the military men and women that gave their lives in Afghanistan for our country.
Amen. And I have to recognize also Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis. She's done a great job in getting some people out of Afghanistan and getting them out of harm's way. Pete is in Brooklyn. Hello.
Sizzle moron.
800-848-9222. Rosemary in Westchester.
Great Mark Shaw interview. Another book, thank you very much, that I have to go to read. And I hope maybe someday he could take some calls when he's on. Thank you.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. You know, I have before with him. We will again in the future. But there's a lot of stuff I didn't even get to. Mike in Pennsylvania, hello.
LeBron did nothing, and the NBA should give give back the money to any New York fan who went to the game last night.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. Irishman in the Bronx.
Read Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. Janine Machine by Richard Blasberg and Twisted Justice at CNN.com. Janine Pierre is an actor.
And finally, Roger is in Massachusetts. Hello.
Yeah, closing the XL pipeline and then now drawing down that strategic oil reserve, it's like quitting your job and then deciding to live off your 401k. I don't know if the environmentalists are going to let us replenish that oil reserve.
Thank you, Roger. All right. That slams the lid on things for today.